everywhere I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the October 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane Armonroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, we have quite a busy show for you. Let's get on with some announcements, first of all. Year 8, the DVD-ROM that many of you have been patiently waiting for years, has indeed started shipping. I've sent to all the domestic addresses, all the ones in the United States first. Those are easy enough to send. I don't actually have to see somebody at the post office to do those. The rest of them should be mailed later today, actually, as I'm recording the show. So you should be looking for that in the mail soon. I've probably contacted you. If you did order a year 8 and you have not heard from me in the past few weeks, let me know. I was trying to get everybody's email address and mailing address up to date so that I shipped it to the right place. But the first units have already started arriving, and the users are loving it. So I'm hoping it'll be well worth the wait. So if you were waiting to actually order a Year 8 DVD until they shipped, well, I can safely say now they are shipping. Which leads me to the next question. A lot of people that I got in contact with regarding the Year 8 DVD asked me about the Decade Collection. We've been talking about that for years, and quite frankly, I didn't want to actually give it any serious thought until after I was sure that the Year 8 DVD was finished. I had a solid technology base, and I was comfortable with these particular DVD endeavors in the current generation of software that I have to use. So I'm fairly confident that we can at least get another set out before they break all my technology once again, and I'm forced to scramble to find something else that works. So here's the deal. The Decade Collection would be 10 years of shows. That's a lot of shows. And a lot of people would like me to do something special for it, not just, you know, taking all the DVDs that are already out, bundling them together, throwing in the extra disc of shows, and, you know, calling it a day. They would like to see something better, something different. And I was giving it some thought. And I'd like to do something very professional. Professional quality printing, professional quality jewel cases. Everything as if it were a complete retail sale. Come up with a new interface. Everything that I would have. Everything classic Retro Gaming Radio I would try to stuff into this Decade Collection. Not only what shipped, but also anything else I could come up with that hasn't shipped or that hasn't been involved in some production somewhere. So in order to make something like that work, obviously that requires a considerable amount of cash to make that happen. And I know most of you are willing to dig up and pay a decent price for the Decade Collector Edition. So the question I have to the listeners is, what's the right price? And what the right price means is, what are we willing to put out for this collection, both myself and the listeners, to make this happen? My thought was, let's do a Kickstarter project, right? This crowdsource funding that is so popular these days. We could literally put together enough cash, and everybody gets the unit as part of their donation, right? Everyone gets the final product, but with that sort of critical mass of people all putting together saying, yes, we want this disc, we want this collection, that would give me a little more incentive, and it would make sure that we keep everybody accountable, right? Keep myself accountable for doing it, and knowing that it's coming from a professional location, right? I would be compiling all the stuff, but we would actually have a DVD distribution factory creating the discs, stamping the discs, and all that stuff. So anyway, I did some math on it because, you know, I'm curious to see what something like that would, how that would work out, right? So I came up with a number And this was not an arbitrary number pulled out of the hat. Okay. So based on the fees involved, and I contacted a DVD mastering facility, mailing materials, postage, having professional graphic design work done, my own programming and labor involved in making it happen, the number I came up with would be $7,200. $7,220 would be the number I came up with based on the numbers I pulled together. And of course, I would disclose all of this, where I pulled those numbers from and what they all mean. And you know, in Kickstarter, they have these different reward levels, right? So if you did not want, let's say you didn't care about the Decade Collection, but you wanted to be somehow involved, right? There's different reward levels based on how much you donate. So putting these numbers all through, the lowest price that I could give somebody the shows on the final product would be $50, right? If I could deliver a certain number of those, then that would pay for the entire funding, right? Those people who want the autographed copy, maybe personalized autograph, maybe an extra copy of the product, that sort of thing, all of those things could be a somewhat higher value, right, to help defray the cost of those that want something smaller. Offer a starving student edition for, like, say, $35. Maybe I make all 10 years of the shows online available, right? So you just get the ones that you want, and it'll cost you $25 to have a limited time access to all 10 years of shows. That sort of thing, right? Record a personal soundbite to you on the disc. That sort of thing. Just something that keeps this kind of fun and light. So I don't know. I'm more interested in hearing what my fans have to say, what the listeners have to say. Does this even sound like it'd be any fun? You know, if you could actually get this Decade Collection for $50 via crowdsourcing, would that be interesting? Would that be interesting to anybody? Or would you prefer to just go the way we've always done it? I'd like to get it out so we can close the chapter on classic Retro Gaming Radio and move forward with what we're going to do with the new Retro Gaming Radio shows that you're listening to right now. So give it some thought. Talk about it in the forums. Send me emails if you don't want to talk about it publicly. I would very, very much like your input as the listeners. One thing that I've been very excited about getting to review is a little thing called the MCC 216. It's a multi-computer console. What this essentially promises to do is combine your favorite classic hardware, Commodore 64, Amiga, Atari 2600, Apple II, ZX Spectrum. All of these units, all of these computers would be wrapped into a single piece of hardware. You plug a PS2 mouse into it, a PS2 keyboard, a USB joystick, or a couple of 9-pin joysticks if you want to use original stuff. And you stick all your games on an SD card, you plug it into this unit, and you play it on your TV, on a VGA monitor. These are all the promises that we've got from this MCC 216. They finally sent me one, but there was absolutely no time for me to get a proper review put together for the show. So while I'm reviewing it, I'm going to have it all done for the November show. So it'll be very exciting. You'll definitely want to catch that if this sounds at all interesting to you. In the meantime, you can check out their homepage just so that you know what I'm talking about, mcc-home.com. And that will give you the whole rundown on exactly what it is, what this multi-classic computer unit is, and how it's supposed to work. And then I'm going to give you the full skinny on how does it perform, because we all know that I am a stickler when it comes to emulation. Also, we have another crowd-funded project going on. We're going to talk about it later. It has to do with Deluxe Galaga, my favorite game from the Amiga, one of my favorite games. And Edgar Vidgel is the programmer of that. He's, as you know, has been doing an offshoot called Warblade for some time. Anyway, my particular problems with Warblade aren't because it's not a quality piece of software. It's because it never quite felt or played the same on a giant high-resolution PC monitor as it did in a lower-resolution Amiga scenario. Well, Edgar is back working on a new project, another Warblade-related project, but this time it's going to be based on the Unity engine. And so it's going to run everywhere. All your mobile devices, all your computers. that gives me a lot of hope. So we're going to talk about that later, but the important part is I'm hoping before next month's show I can get an interview. First time. I've been talking to Edgar online for decades at this point, I think. And he's always been a great guy to talk to, but he's agreed to give us an interview. And I don't think he does a whole lot of these, so this will be a special treat. And finally, for next month, I'm going to have a review of the 8-bitty ThinkGeek iCade wireless controller. So those are all what's coming up next month. I know you're excited about next month, right? So what do we got for you this month? We got some new reader mail. We've got a new editorial commentary called Learning from History, the Success or Failure of Aftermarket Controllers. We continue our anniversary collection, looking this month at the ColecoVision, one of my favorite consoles of all time. We also have a new feature, Shane's Scary Games. It's Halloween after all. And so I'm going to look at a handful of games that scared the bejesus out of me while I was growing up. Of course, we have our regular bits and bytes. We're going to update you on digital pinball. Both the major packages, the Pinball Arcade and Zen Pinball, have had a number of tables come out since the last show. And I'd like to update you and tell you what's worth your cash and what's not. All of this and so much more are going to be here on this show this month on Retro Gaming Radio. Stay tuned. This month's editorial commentary I call Learning from History, the Success or Failure of Aftermarket Controllers. Now, what I mean by aftermarket controllers are those controllers you make after the purchase of the original console. Most of the time, these aftermarket purchases, these days anyway, involves buying a second controller. For example, most of the modern consoles now come with a single controller to keep the cost down, and you purchase an additional controller ranging anywhere from $30 to $50 to $60, $70 for an additional controller, which is why, obviously, they only put one in the box. However, it wasn't always like that. There were a number of different devices, like the ColecoVision we'll be talking about this month. Many of the early consoles came with two controllers because they realized that video gaming was a family or family and friends type affair. So they included the extra controller in the box, knowing that it would be immediately made use of. And in some cases, that offered developers an incentive to create games that might work with two joysticks at the same time, such as a Robotron-type game, or simply the fact that they would spend more time coding in two-player-type support for games, right? If you're going to write a game for a console and the unit only shipped with one controller, that's your guaranteed base. So has there ever really been an overwhelming success story for aftermarket controllers? Every generation, every console, without fail, has had aftermarket controllers. In some cases, such as recently, aftermarket controllers are actually playing catch-up with other consoles. Obviously, most recently, we're talking, of course, about the Nintendo Wii. When the Wii came out, there was no mainstream console that had motion-type controls. Within a very short period of time, Sony jumped on board with the PS Move, which was very, very close to the Wii's motion control wands. And then, shortly thereafter, Microsoft jumped in on the body as a controller with the Kinect. So these are great methodologies of catch-up, and in some cases, catching up, such as the Kinect, is arguably superior to the original. But can these aftermarket controllers really truly be a success? What drives aftermarket controllers? Well, playing catch-up is obviously one, right? And that is an understandable situation, right? That's how businesses work in general, especially technology. Something big hits, everybody kind of clones it. Something else big hits, they move along with that. But it's always the people that instantiate that disruption that tend to typically benefit from it, right? What else drives aftermarket controller sales? Well, obviously, different genres of gaming drive that, right? The Xbox controller, for example, is a very good controller. However, a lot of people would argue it's not exactly what you would call a fighting controller, right? You wouldn't want to play Mortal Kombat with it, although you can. It's much better suited for a generic type video game that runs on the Xbox. Look at, say, the Atari 2600 with the standard stiff controls that the Atari 2600 shipped with, the iconic joystick with the single red button and that stick that you just want to bash your head into the wall because it is really, it doesn't move very much, right? So aftermarket controllers tend to try to fill a need by third-party gaming or by the users themselves, right? A lot of people enjoy the giant bat handle controllers, right, that came out from WICO. Those are the sort of aftermarket controllers. They don't change what the console is capable of, mind you, some of these aftermarket controllers. Some of them do. But a lot of them are just trying to give you more comfort. For example, the Intellivision, right? Those horrible disc controllers. Everyone says those are great and revolutionary because there's like 32 directions on there. I don't care. It's the most uncomfortable controller right behind the ColecoVision controller. So what did somebody do? They created an aftermarket controller. It wasn't even a controller. It was a suction cup with a joystick on it you could stick onto that disc. And then you actually had something closer to the ColecoVision, which was a usable joystick-type device or a thumbstick-type device. So aftermarket controllers have a number of different reasons for coming out. And there is a huge market to be had. Am I right? Nyko, Mad Catz, both big names today, guaranteed when a new console comes out, they will have controllers following right behind it. And a lot of them do the exact same things as the first party controllers. But their job is to make cheaper alternatives, or maybe smaller alternatives, or to skin them with IPs like Hello Kitty or whatever it is. Whatever gamers want, these companies are dedicated to putting out. But there have been some success stories in aftermarket controllers. Let's take a look at just a handful of them. On the Atari 2600, it's arguable that the paddle controllers were a successful aftermarket controller. How did that work? It came packed in, I believe, Indy 500 was the game it came with, a driving game, a racing game. And it just turned out that paddles also happen to be good for sporting type games like tennis, as well as some of the great iconic games of the time, such as Kaboom, right? Paddle controllers gave you a very precise analog style control over your on-screen avatar, if you will. So that was very popular, and the developers actually wrote software for that because so many people had them. I would consider the Atari 2600 paddles a rare success story in aftermarket controllers. The Atari 5200 had a roller controller. Now, this was a, and we've talked about this in the past. What's the guy's name that did that? We've had him on the show, and I'm sorry, his name suddenly eludes me. We had the guy that created that roller controller, and it was actually a top-notch, high-quality arcade-style roller controller. Unfortunately, it was price prohibitive, it was expensive, and that was just by parts, not Atari's creepy markup. As well as, of course, the fact that the 5200 just didn't do as well as it could have done. So that really stifled that particular market. It's popular in the fact that it's a very desired and highly coveted aftermarket controller to own for collectors, but I don't know if I would actually consider it a, quote, success. ColecoVision, we talked about them, and we're going to talk about them a lot more coming up in the show. They had a number of different add-on controllers, some of which actually did change how the games were played. They had a roller controller, much like the 5200 did. They had a super action controller and a driving controller, an actual wheel. As far as I know, that's the first console that ever had a wheel add-on for driving games. And we're going to talk more about that. Were any of them successful? I would say no. I would say they came with a pack-in game that was fantastic, right? The roller controller came with Slither, which was a great game. Super action controller for a while shipped with Rocky Boxing. That was a good game. And the driving controller, they all came with Turbo. So essentially what you were really doing was buying a game and you're paying a little extra to get a good dedicated controller. Unfortunately, Sure, there was four or five other games that made use of the driving controller. There was a couple of other sports games that used the Super Action controller, and the roller controller happened to be usable, it turns out, by other software that would make that it made sense to use it for, but games weren't specifically written for them. So I don't know if we'd really call those a success or not. Now, Nintendo, of course, when the NES came out, they had a number of their own different add-ons, including a light gun, a power glove, now you're playing with power, and, of course, the arcade advantage. Now, this was a perfect example, I personally think, of a success story. The light gun came packed in with Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt, right? That's the ultimate pack-in. You have a gun to play Duck Hunt with. They did have a handful of other games that used it, but to say that that really was a huge success story, no. Power Glove, absolutely not a huge success story. But what about the arcade advantage? This was an arcade-style controller that did away with the little tiny box with the D-pad and a couple of buttons on it. This actually took the Nintendo box controller, I believe is what it's fondly called by its fans, and turned it into a full-blown arcade-style, what we would almost call a fighting stick now. So I would say that was a very successful aftermarket controller. One, because it was first party, and second, because it really did fill a very specific need that wasn't being met. And it did not change. It could simply be used as an advantage, not as a replacement controller that you would need custom programming for, like a roller controller. You'd have to write the game to make use of the roller controller. But a lot of games, including the big ones like Super Mario Brothers, those games could be immediately taken advantage of with the arcade advantage. Maybe that's why they called it the advantage. The NES was the next system out, and that had one of the main peripherals or secondary type controllers. They had a couple of aftermarket controllers, but the bigger one that most people would remember would be the Mario Paint mouse. And let's be honest, that went absolutely nowhere, right? If you were playing Mario Paint with it, great. Otherwise, meh. The GameCube wasn't far off either. The GameCube featured a set of bongo drums to play a Donkey Kong rhythm game. And a microphone, which I cannot off the top of my head, and I don't have it in my notes. I don't remember anything that used the microphone. I would say that those sort of peripherals did not render success for GameCube. And most people, I will say that there was one aftermarket controller on the GameCube that you could say was a huge success, and that was the WaveBird. And for those of you who are not familiar with that, the WaveBird was a high gigahertz wireless controller that allowed you to play, I believe for the first time, and somebody might have to correct me on that, my Nintendo history is a little weak, that was the first time I think that you could play a game with a wireless controller like that. Could be wrong. But that was huge, and the WaveBird was extremely popular, and it still is today. People are still trying to get their paws on one. Of course, there's a million knockoffs of the WaveBird, but none of them quite worked as well as the original WaveBird. So I would consider the WaveBird a successful aftermarket controller. Not to spend too much time in Nintendo land, the Sega Genesis. If you remember, the original Sega Genesis shipped with a three-button D-pad style controller with two shoulder buttons. Well, that obviously became inadequate because there were a lot of arcade games such as the venerable Mortal Kombat which used more than three buttons. This spawned out a six-button controller, an official aftermarket controller by Sega. And this did extraordinarily well. So well, in fact, it became the pack-in controller with later models. So I'm not really sure we'd call that an aftermarket controller, but for the sake of argument, we had to talk about it. And, of course, this was a very big success story, right? Much like the NES Advantage, it's what should have been in the box to begin with, right? That's what kind of people think about it. Dreamcast, of course, had its own massive set of peripherals, a light gun, a fishing rod, a microphone, a steering wheel, and at one point I think I owned every single one of those. Mm-hmm. And you could arguably call the VMU, the virtual memory unit that plugged into the controller, you could almost call that an aftermarket controller as well. Were any of these really a success? Unfortunately, the Dreamcast itself wasn't exactly the success that it could have been, even though I think it's one of the greatest consoles of all time. We have to be honest, from a marketing perspective, despite the fact that there are still hobby groups developing for the Dreamcast and there are huge, huge fan groups going on out there, the Dreamcast just wasn't the success it could have been, unfortunately. And thus, the controllers would be considered probably not a popular aftermarket controller. As I stated before, many of these peripherals are pack-ins, right? Somebody said, listen, we got this new game, and we need this pack-in controller to make it great. Unfortunately, because it was made by a third-party developer, because it is only really designed for one game, very few developers are going to alienate the other millions of people. It's a crazy deal. Pack-ins tend to work, but unfortunately just for the one game that they're packed in with. Sometimes you get another one, right? Sometimes they'll take and a game will support or enhance their game for another controller, but let's be honest, it's a fairly rare story. And how do you explain this, right? If you have a superior controller or a secondary aftermarket controller, why wouldn't developers want to use it? It's all about the numbers, right? Developers don't like non-native controllers. There's a certain risk involved, right? Think about it. The Super Action controller, you add it to the ColecoVision, right? How many people actually have that? Well, today, you could run a poll on the internet, and you could probably get a fairly realistic number right now. Unfortunately, back in the ColecoVision days, you didn't have a whole lot of idea how many Super Action controllers were really out there. Right? So developers don't like to take the risk. They don't like to support something that's not already in the box. And if you want to look for modern failures, they're all over the place, right? The Wii Speak is a good example. That was a horrible add-on peripheral that just simply did not work, right? This Microsoft Glass, this is a potential failure, right? This, I'm telling you, I don't care what anybody says, everybody's chasing Nintendo these days because Nintendo is really the ones making money hand over fist on their consoles. So Microsoft chasing the touchscreen gamepad of the new Wii U has come up with something called MS Glass or Microsoft Glass, which is supposed to tie in their Surface products with their video games. And apparently there is some useful functionality behind it, but it's never going to be quite what Nintendo's got going on. For several reasons. One, unless it's packed in the box with an Xbox, they can't guarantee everyone's going to have it. So they're reaching out to cell phones. They're reaching out to tablets. They're trying to tap that existing market to work their aftermarket stuff. But unfortunately, there is simply a huge fragmentation base of product. You can never guarantee things like latency and all this other stuff. So I do not see the Glass project being anything more than an interesting duplication of the gamepad. Now, here's the cool thing. Sometimes you get a pack-in that's just so good that you're dying to have other software use it, and you start a campaign and beg people to use it. One of the things that I had was over in Japan, they released the game Arkanoid, right? Arkanoid's that, you know, ball and bat brick breaking game, right, that had lasers, and it was the very first of the advanced super breakouts, if you will. Well, in Japan, they released a dedicated Arkanoid spinner, right, because Arkanoid in the arcade was played with a spinner controller. They released that, and it's a top-notch peripheral. It's well-built, and what's even better is most spinners do not feel like arcade spinners. Those of you who have spun an arcade spinner know what I'm talking about. There's a feeling behind an arcade spinner that can't be matched with these cheap home versions, right? Because it it requires some decent hardware. Well, these guys released a very top-notch Arkanoid spinner controller that actually plugged into the Game Boy Advance port of the DS. And it was fantastic. It's the only way to play Arkanoid. And unfortunately, despite the fact that it was a huge success in Japan, apparently, and it was top quality, top notch, it really added an air to the game that was fantastic. Unfortunately, no one else ended up using it. So, failure despite, it was like one of the best aftermarket controllers I'd ever laid my hands on. So how do you do this? How does a company successfully market one of these? How did it work in the past? Right? We've talked about a couple of success stories, the NES Advantage, the six-button controller with Genesis, and in modern times you could actually call the Wii Balance Board, which supports some 80-something games, which is blows me away. The Balance Board has 80 games, first-party and third-party support, so I would consider the Wii Balance Board a successful aftermarket controller. So how do these work? What do we attribute the successes of these aftermarket controllers? Well, let's look at the NES Advantage. In this case, I think it was a combination of strong first-party support, right? Nintendo plastered, the NES Advantage stick was right next to the NES on the shelf. You couldn't miss it. In fact, you almost picked it up because you thought it was part of the set, right? So there was a specific branding and placement involved. It also, a lot of people complained about the initial NES controllers. They didn't like that little boxy controller. It was apparently great in Japan, but the U.S. market wasn't as thrilled with it up front as the Japanese market was. So this was an alternative, right? It's like, oh, well, we understand you're not a fan of this, but here's this. And I seem to remember it had a fairly healthy markup as well. So this was a case also of providing something that was not in the box that was definitely necessary for some gamers to engage your system. So those are some of the concepts, right? What about the six-button Genesis controller? We kind of talked about that, right? Gaming technology and arcade porting required more than three buttons. It was just that simple. When the Genesis first came out, three buttons was enough. And when you're trying to chase arcade ports, you have to be able to replicate the controls. And I think that drove Sega. It was a first-party controller, so that helped. Much like Nintendo, hey, you know, a lot of people follow Nintendo, what can I tell you? Sega said, listen, we're going to put these right on the shelf, right next to it. And as I recall, there were a couple of budget bundles of the Sega Genesis that only had one controller with it. That definitely gave, an incentive for these developers to say, listen, we're only going to program for one controller. If they have a second one, great. And we have to program for the controller that's built in, which is a three-button controller. Well, Sega was a little too late in getting that six-button controller in there to get what I would consider super wide support. A lot of games use the six-button controller. That's not an argument. However, I think that they really missed out by giving that second controller, that six-button controller, so late in the game. But it was a success because, much like Nintendo, there was good first-party marketing, there was good product placement with the controller, and it definitely filled a need of something that was not inside the box. And, of course, it was backward compatible. So even if you did have a three-button game, you could still use the six-button controller with it. The same thing with the Advantage. Not so much with, say, the ColecoVision's roller controller, or the Power Glove, or the Super Action controller, or paddles, etc., or the mouse that came with the Super Nintendo's Mario Paint. These things were not immediately interchangeable with their counterparts. The Wii Balance Board was simply, I think Nintendo really encouraged developers to use it, and I think developers were enchanted a little bit by it. I think they saw it as something very fun and very new, and Wii Fit sold so many units. Wii Fit was so popular that developers said, listen, we've got an install base of millions of these boards. It makes sense that we add a little something to our games to make use of it. And they did. And I think that's what really caused that third-party support that Nintendo managed to garner with the Wii Balance Board is what made it work. So why do we care? Why are we even talking about this? We've talked over 20 minutes about aftermarket controllers, how they're largely failures. So why are we even talking about this? Well, I'm a big believer that if you don't learn from history, you are destined to make the same mistakes. And we are seeing that happen even now, right? We talked a little bit about this with the Microsoft Glass. The PS Move, huge failure, right? Well, I wouldn't say huge failure, but let's be honest. Ain't no Wii. Kinect got a very good support. There's a good number of games out for it. But to even put it in the same league as motion controls on the Nintendo Wii, not even there. Not even close, right? So we need to continue to learn why and for what purpose do we need aftermarket controls. In some cases, developers realize that for a flight simulator, we're going to need a $200 flight stick with all the trimmings, right? If you want a realistic flight simulator, you're going to pay for essentially a flight control deck. Right? That's gonna happen. And that's worthwhile. To think that any single game after that is going to use that controller, buyer beware, because it's probably not gonna happen. When it comes to, chasing technology, I say watch yourself carefully. Right? And it's for all the things we talked about. To say, oh, well, you know, the PS3 has motion controls and it's not popular, so it must suck on the Wii as well. Well, no, right? It's a matter of implementation. It's a matter of getting developer support. If the thing is not in the box, this is the bottom line, folks. If the controller is not in the box, do not expect developer support for it. Expect a one-off game. Expect a two-off game. That drawing tablet that came out, the U-Draw, I think, that came out from, was it Ubisoft? Yeah, they tried to push that everywhere. They pushed it on the Wii, which it had a small amount of success, but not much. Then they tried to take it to the 360 and the PS3, and it bombed like nobody's business. So, listen, folks, developers especially, and console manufacturers, stop chasing. If you want to disrupt, if you want to reinvent the controller, you must take the initial risk and put it in the box with your console if you want any sort of adoption. Don't try to jump on the bandwagon later with a PS Move or a Kinect. Don't try to jump on the bandwagon later with the MS Glass. What you're asking to these console makers, what you are asking is for someone else to take the risk and you ride the coattails. Don't do that. If you really, really want to take a chance, follow Nintendo's lead. Take a chance. Come up with something radical and different. Stick it in the box. Let developers know you care enough and you support this technology and you believe in it enough to actually spend the money and put it inside the box. History can teach us a lot, folks. All you got to do is open up a book. Open up a page, surf to it, however you want to get to it, but history is already laid out there, and history doesn't tend to lie. So, I guess that's going to do it for this segment. I had another couple of notes here, but I think this has run the gambit. So, I hope you enjoyed this editorial commentary. Join us next month for yet my views on another possibly hot topic in the video gaming industry and in retro gaming. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. This month's reader mail comes from Doug McCauley. Doug writes, I just wanted to let you know that I absolutely just love your show and look forward to each month. I'm a fairly new listener and discovered your show only a couple of months ago, and what a valuable resource it has become. I do a lot of gaming on Android and iOS devices, especially in regards to MAME games. As a result, I've been waiting for a controller that ThinkGeek has been promising to the market for what seems close to a year so far and is now finally available. Since you do a lot of gaming, retro and mobile, I thought you'd be interested in this information. It'd be awesome to hear your feedback review over the RSS. I ordered mine today and obviously have not received it. I hope I made a wise investment, especially since the device is not OS specific like so many other controllers. It appears to be an IK device, probably their best device yet. I have attached a link for your information. On a side note, it would be totally awesome if you could also discuss some of the emulation consoles, such as the Pandora, the Canoe, the Dingu, XJD, or JXD, etc. A lot of gamers cannot afford a hardware solution, so emulation might be the next best thing. Take care and keep up the good work, Doug McCauley. Well, Doug, as you have probably already heard before reading your letter, we are going to be looking at that controller next month. So, obviously it'll be a little late for you, but I will be talking about it for those who have not yet ordered and are wondering if it's worth the $30 that they're asking for it. As for emulation on other consoles, I did do a complete look at the one of the JXD devices a few shows ago. You might have missed that. And we have talked about the GP2X and some other of the Korean handhelds in the past. However, I simply don't have access to the hardware for Pandora and some of these other newer ones. Now, I do know that the producer, Alex J. Lopez, has some of these devices, so maybe I can get him to look at these for you, or maybe I can convince him to send it my way for a little while and let me take a look at these. I know that emulation runs in a number of different platforms, and we obviously don't want to just limit it to a certain subset of devices, so thanks, Doug, for writing in, and I think you'll be very pleased with the show in the future, as we are going to be talking about some of the very things you've asked about. So, good stuff. Thanks for writing in. And please, if you do have mail you'd like us to get, send it to Shane R. Monroe at RetroGamingRadio.com. Or, of course, you can always send it into Bits and Bytes at RetroGamingRadio.com. I'll see it there as well. So, thanks again. I love reading your mail, so please keep them coming. All right, gang. It's time for our monthly anniversary tribute. This month, we are giving the 30-year salute to ColecoVision. And, wow, boy, let me tell you, I've got so many stories and so much to talk about with ColecoVision. This is going to run a little while. So let's jump right into it. The ColecoVision was released in August of 1982. Very modest specifications. It had 3.5 megahertz Z80 processor from NEC, a video processor from Texas Instruments featuring 256 by 192 pixel resolution, 32 sprites, 16 colors, a TI sound chip from Texas Instruments, 3-tone, 1-noise, kind of similar to the 64. You're seeing some common factors here, right? 16K of VRAM, 1K of regular RAM, 8K of onboard ROM, and the cartridges ranged anywhere from 8K to 32K. Now, let's do some comparisons here, because you can throw numbers around all day long, but a lot of people say, well, what the hell is a ColecoVision, right? Well, you probably know what a 5200 is, and you probably know what an Intellivision is. You probably know what a Commodore 64 is. So let's do some comparisons. The 5200 had a 6502C processor running at 1.75 megahertz, 320 by 192, 16 colors. Though apparently you could do a 256 color trick, but we'll stick with the base thing there, and 4-channel sound. The Commodore 64 had a 6510 chip, essentially a 6502 with some extra pipelines in there, running at only 1 megahertz. So the ColecoVision ran, you know, 3.5 times faster than the C64. How about that? The C64 did run, though, at 320 by 200, upping the resolution, 16 colors, 8 hardware sprites, smooth scrolling, which really made a difference on a lot of games, and 3-channel synthesizer, a.k.a. the SID chip. And what about our buddy the Intellivision? 1610 16-bit processor. Unfortunately, it was clocked at less than 1 megahertz. Very low resolution at 159 by 192, 16 colors, 8 hardware sprites, 3 channels, plus 1 noise. So there you go. There's no definitive winner in there. Obviously, you can look at features from each one and go, wow, that's definitely better there. It's definitely better there. What really made a difference for me in terms of these kind of comparisons, right? The Intellivision was just, I don't know, you know, the Intellivision was never on my radar. Nobody I knew owned one. They had one set up at Sears for display, and you could choose to pick, you know, you could play demo games up to like 10 games, but they all timed out after like 3 minutes. So you never really got a chance to actually play any of the game all the way through. Nobody I knew owned a 5200. You know, I knew a lot of people with Atari 400s and 800s, which some fell somewhere in that range, but Never knew anybody with a 5200. But the Commodore 64, for me, it was about the sound, and it was about the smooth graphics, which is the smooth scrolling thing, which is why I brought it up. What do people remember the most about the ColecoVision? That's right. Absolutely horrible controllers. Really just one step above Intellivision. To give you a mental picture, take a cell phone, stretch it out a little bit, right? Make it longer. Put your cell phone in your hand, right? Say you got a 4.5 inch cell phone. Hold that in your hand. Stretch it out to about, I've got my Galaxy Nexus in my hand. I'm trying to give you a visual here. And expand it about 2 or 3 inches. So, yeah, there we go. And the controller featured two independent fire buttons. One that you would fire with your trigger finger, and the other one you were supposed to fire with your thumb. Now, just hold your thumb and your trigger finger on the side of your phone like that and see how comfortable that was. Fortunately, most of them fired with the trigger finger or the, quote, right button. In the middle was a full keypad with those horrible, like, they're not chiclets, but they're like bubbles that you push in. Remember those? The bubble buttons? Yeah, I'm trying to think of what else had those. There was one of the really horrible portable computers that had something like that. Anyway, so they had, and that let you slip in overlays, just like in television. You could take a cool looking overlay, slide it in, and then you could push the buttons on the overlay, you know, fire missile or reload or whatever. On the top, where the actual joystick was, facing the front was a large round disc. It was raised up about an inch, inch and a half off the plastic, and you grasp the disc with your hand. Now, my hand's cramping just thinking about holding this controller. But you wrapped your hand around this disc, and you move the disc up and down, left and right. It was not a pleasant sight. But hey, at least the ColecoVision came with two of them, right? You can't say that today. However, there were alternate controllers available. One of the things that people remember about the ColecoVision is the expansion modules. And we're going to talk more about the expansion modules later. One of the expansion modules, which is really funny because the expansion modules were supposed to plug into the front where it said expansion slot. Expansion module 1 actually did plug into that slot, but expansion module 2 did not. Expansion module 2 was a driving controller. It was just like what you would think it would be. It's a box with a big steering wheel coming off of it. You put one of the ColecoVision controllers right next to the steering wheel. They had a little slot for it. You put that down, and then you use that horrible little disc as a gear shift for turbo to go fast, you know, slow or fast, or what is it, low and high speed. Then they gave you a gas pedal. That's right, a gas pedal. You're sitting there going, this is like the greatest thing ever. I mean, this is what, 1982, and they're popping out gas pedals and steering wheels. The gas pedal was an on-off switch, okay? It was either you had the gas on or you had the gas off. It's not like there was a, you know, it's not like it was an analog control. Everything in there was digital. But that was packed in with Turbo, the arcade game Turbo. It did work with a few other games, which is unusual because most of these pack-in controllers, as we talked about earlier, tend not to. But Dukes of Hazzard, Pit Stop Destructor, and a couple other ones actually worked with Expansion Module 2, which did not plug into the Expansion Module slot. Another controller that came out for the ColecoVision was the Roller Controller, which was a trackball, and it actually wasn't bad as long as you kept it clean. This thing was packed in with the game Slither, which was sort of ColecoVision's answer to Centipede. It wasn't a bad game, but the Roller Controller really never worked for any other titles, although you could use it for a couple of games like War Games. War Games was a game that, well, based on the movie, of course, but in War Games, you actually used the joystick controller, the joy circle controller, if you will. You used that to move a cursor around the screen. Well, the trackball or the Roller Controller worked really well for that. So scrolling around the screen with that trackball really worked well, but the games were never actually made for it. Roller Controller was pretty much a pack-in for Slither. Lastly, one of the things that you see lots of pictures of when people talk about ColecoVision, the Super Action controllers. These were almost like boxing gloves. You would grasp them like the hilt of a gun. In front was like this plastic barrier in front of your fingers, so it almost looked like it was protecting your hands, so they looked like boxing gloves. There was absolutely no reason for that thing to be there. I don't even think for stability or build quality or anything. There was absolutely zero need for that thing to be there, but it was. And it gave it a distinguishable look to it. Anyway, so if you grasp, imagine hold your hand out, grasp like you're holding the gun. All four fingers had their own buttons, making this easily the most complicated controller of all time. So you had all four fingers had a joystick button assigned to them. On the top, thank God, was a real joystick. It was a stick coming out with a big red ball, like the Wico ball controller. And you could grasp that, and actually it made sense. So you'd hold the controller in your left hand, let's say, with all your fire buttons on your fingers, and then you could grasp the ball on top and actually use it as a controller. It worked pretty good, actually. Also on the top was a reproduction of the keypad, so that you could, select the starting of the game or whatever, or you couldn't put an overlay on it, but you didn't really need it for much. And there was also, oddly enough, on the top, a spinner. Now, this was I don't know what was in there, but it was a pretty crappy spinner. And it was up on its side, and you would spin it. I think this is how you got up from Rocky Boxing. I don't remember for sure, but if you got knocked down, you would run your hand across that spinner really fast. And, basically take an old mouse. Here's where you can get the idea. Take an old mouse with a ball underneath it, hold it on its side, and then roll that ball with the other hand. That's kind of the idea. I'm sure it uses basically the same technology too. So that was actually kind of cool though. I mean, it had four buttons on a 1982 console. Its pack-in was Super Action Baseball, but it was really designed, and I think originally it was going to be a pack-in until they figured out they could sell it better separately, for Super Action Boxing, which was, an IP shell or a vehicle for the Rocky Boxing, the whole Rocky Boxing movie tie-in. And there was a port of Frontline, the arcade game from Taito, that you could also use that for. Although I never got to play it with that. Coleco's biggest claim to fame was reinventing the concept of the pack-in. Pack-ins are nothing new. We all know what pack-ins are. You buy a console. Well, we used to. We used to buy a console, and there would be a game in it. And, we see a little bit of that. Like, the Wii had Wii Sports built, as a pack-in. Some Atari 2600s had bundles that included Asteroids, right? The Asteroids pack. But ColecoVision came out of the box, not just with a pack-in, but with what I would consider the killer app for the ColecoVision. A killer app is something that you buy the system for. In other words, you don't have a ColecoVision or console X, name whatever console you want. I don't have I don't have a Gizmondo X console. Something that comes as a piece of software, an application or a game that you can get for the console, is so good, it's worth buying the console to play. That's the killer app. Well, instead of including a billion other different possibilities they could have packed in, they packed in Donkey Kong. Now, this just wasn't another crappy, half-assed port of Donkey Kong. And just from a game perspective, Donkey Kong was incredibly popular. I mean, incredibly popular, right? It was also the closest arcade version that there was at the time. Nothing else could touch it. I mean, it was so good. I mean, there were people who were saying it looked just like the arcade game. Now, that's not true. It did not look exactly like the arcade game. But it was so close. It was definitely the best-looking Donkey Kong of anything you could get at home. They packed it in for free with every single ColecoVision. You couldn't buy a ColecoVision that didn't have Donkey Kong. It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Now, it cost Coleco $250,000 up front to license Donkey Kong, and Nintendo took $1.40 per cartridge, right? In my opinion, they got off light based on how much money and how many units that they sold. Now, the interesting thing that a lot of people don't know is Coleco had the original exclusive rights to Donkey Kong on consoles. That's pretty interesting. I did not know that. They owned the rights. Now, what you probably remember is a little story that went along back here with this whole debacle, was that Universal sued Nintendo for Donkey Kong, saying that Donkey Kong ripped off King Kong because it's a giant gorilla. Now, if Coleco had become casualties of that war, they may not. I mean, they may have fizzled out a lot faster than they did. The Donkey Kong was pivotal to making ColecoVision work. And if they had lost that case, if Nintendo had lost that case with Universal, they would not have been able to license the game. And ColecoVision would not have been the success it was. As far as I know, and somebody could correct me on this one, I think, personally, that Donkey Kong defines the term killer app. That's where it spawned from. I mean, it wasn't called Killer App, but it's a game you bought the system for. So by Christmas of 1982, now listen carefully, let's go back. August of 1982 is when it came out. By Christmas of 1982, so December, sorry, August, September, October, November, December, 4 months, they had sold, not shipped, sold 500,000 ColecoVisions. Absolutely insane. ColecoVision was also noted for its famous 12-second startup. Anybody who owned a ColecoVision knew exactly what this was, and it pissed everybody off. You put a cartridge in the ColecoVision, it's powered off. You turn it on, and for 12 seconds, you have to stare at a ColecoVision screen that tells you the name of the game. 12 seconds. That doesn't sound like very long. But when you're dying to play some Donkey Kong, 12 seconds is forever. Now, here's something interesting. There's, as with everything of this nature, hey, Dan, cats are beating the crap out of everything over here. As with any of these sort of things, there's always a story, and as with most stories, it's not true. So, one of the reasons that was commonly cited was that Coleco invested in advertising for the system. Right? I think at some point in time, they were going to put ads on that front page. I think that's really where the 12-second step came from. They figured if they were going to have an ad on there, they needed to hold it for 12 seconds. Now, that's brilliant. That's thinking well outside the box. I mean, think about that. We're in 1982, and these guys are already working on this level of advertising? Absolutely crazy. Well, they were so popular, right? They sold 500,000 units. Now, we'll never get confirmation that that's the story, but that's my belief. So, one of the official urban legends that was going around at the time was that Coleco was so invested in this system, and they were selling so many of them, that the ColecoVision's quirky assembly language that it used for games, very few people knew how to program for it, right? So we had this excellent piece of hardware. We could make great games, but we didn't have enough programmers to actually make this stuff. So the engineers at Coleco, this is how the rumor mill goes, the engineers at Coleco created an emulator that would allow programmers to program in Pascal, which a lot of people knew how to do. So they got programmers for Pascal to come in, write code that would run emulated on the ColecoVision under this emulation. But of course, the problem was, of course, that it required 12 seconds for the emulator to boot up before the game could transfer over to the cartridge. Interesting story, has a hint of potential truth, but no, the story is not true. The boot after disassembly, right, after, the video game crash and people started taking these things apart and decompiling it, they found out that the ColecoVision BIOS, the boot up of the system, if you will, it had a 12-second delay built into the BIOS for absolutely no reason. It just sat there and slept for 12 seconds. It wasn't doing anything. It wasn't initiating anything. It wasn't doing anything at all. There was literally a 12-second built-in timer that would not let you go into the game without waiting the 12 seconds. So don't tell me that advertising wasn't what they were thinking about doing. Why else would you force someone to look at a screen for 12 seconds? I'm telling you, they were going to litter those games with ads. So anyway, some companies, as you know if you owned a ColecoVision, some companies like Parker Brothers and Activision and Microfun figured out a way to get around that. And for you techie types, what they had to do was they found a loop in the BIOS that they could hook into. The problem is the 12-second delay happened before the BIOS finished loading. So what these guys had to do was they had to essentially duplicate the last third of the BIOS code, put it into their cartridges. That way, when they hit the bypass loop in the BIOS, they would essentially boot the last piece of the BIOS from their own cartridge and then transfer control over to their code. That's why when you put in Gyrus and you turned it on, there was no delay. It instantly popped up on the screen. However, that did cost them because they had to duplicate that code and put it into their cartridge. I don't remember how much it was, but essentially it cost them coding space. But for them and for us, it was definitely worth it. ColecoVision was known as the king of arcade ports, and they had more arcade ports than you can shake a stick at. Some of them you knew and you knew well. Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., Mr. Do, Frenzy, right? But a lot of them came from a little company known as Exidy. And Exidy had tons and tons of games that you probably know, but you didn't know they were from Exidy. Carnival, Ladybug, Mousetrap, Venture, Cosmic Avengers, Space Panic, Subrock, I think was from them. No, Subrock was from Sega. I don't remember. Anyway, suffice to say, they had a license and they had the ability to create those arcade ports. So some of the other ports that you may or may not know, Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator, Time Pilot, right? They had access to a lot of stuff. Along with the arcade ports, ColecoVision cranked out a ton of 8-bit computer games, and oddly enough, they were a lot of the ones that were available at the exact same time for the Commodore 64. Things like Antarctic Adventure, BC's Quest for Tires, Beam Rider, Boulder Dash, Choplifter, Gateway to Abshai, huh? Gateway to Abshai, could you imagine playing that with a ColecoVision controller? Hero, Jumpman Jr., no Jumpman, but we got Jumpman Jr., Miner 2049er, Pitfall, Pit Stop, and a bunch of other 8-bit titles, things that you probably recognize from Commodore 64 land. And a lot of this was due to the fact that Microfun and a couple of other developers were creating content for both at the same time. Now, ColecoVision was wiping the floor with the other consoles. The 2600, while still venerable, you know, everyone still loved it, and there was so much software for the 2600, it was insane. That's probably why we had a crash. No quality control, but that's neither here nor there. But Intellivision, which wasn't wiping the floor up with anybody, but ColecoVision just came in and beat the crap out of everybody. In fact, they would often, ColecoVision commercials would often show their version of Donkey Kong, their version of Donkey Kong Jr., right next to an inferior port to the 2600 or the Intellivision. I mean, this was like Coke versus Pepsi all over again. They were happy to point out how horrible the graphics were on the other systems. Now let's throw a little more wood on the fire. ColecoVision then created what they called expansion module number one, the one that I told you actually plugged into the front of the ColecoVision. This was the most brilliant move you could possibly do. Take your number one competitor, Atari, and not just run your software, but run their software too. So for $60, you could buy a module that plugged into the front of the ColecoVision, and you could plug in not only your Atari 2600 joysticks that you already had laying around, you could also plug in and run your Atari 2600 games. That's right. They created an Atari on a chip, essentially, and built expansion module one was an Atari 2600. It later came out as the Gemini, a standalone Atari 2600 compatible unit. Well, you think Atari was going to settle for that? Absolutely not. They sued like nobody's business to get ColecoVision to stop producing expansion module number one. Unfortunately, ColecoVision was smarter than them. Yeah, well, see, Atari created their main chips and their main hardware and their unit through off-the-shelf components. And unfortunately, they failed to actually patent their reconstruction of said off-the-shelf components. So Coleco figured out they could duplicate and create the TIA chip and everything else and not require any parts or authority from Atari to do so. Yeah, so Atari lost the lawsuit, meaning that Expansion Module 1 was free and clear to sell. Now, what are you going to buy? An Atari 2600, which plays Atari 2600 games, or are you going to buy a ColecoVision with Expansion Module 1 that you can have near arcade ports as well as all the old software that you spent tons of cash on that you don't want to get rid of? It's a no-brainer, right? The ultimate in backward compatibility is when you're not backward with your own crap, you're backward compatible with the guys that you're in competition with. Absolutely brilliant. Now, there wasn't, let's just say it wasn't without its issues. It was almost perfect. It was perfect in terms of the internals, right? It was an Atari 2600. But some cartridges had unusual shells around them. You know, if you take apart a 2600 cartridge, there's a little tiny motherboard in there, right? The plastic shell is what really hugs the system and gives them, you know, opens up the cartridge port when you plug it in, that sort of thing. Well, there were a handful of games, fortunately not many, for Coleco anyway, not for Atari, that had a different type of a shell that would not fit into the expansion module number one's Atari 2600 port. So they were out of luck to play those games. So while it was not 100% compatible, it could be if you were willing to tear open your 2600 cartridge and just stuff the board right in there, which some people actually did do. As we mentioned, Expansion Module 2 was released shortly thereafter, featuring the driving controller. This thing ran on batteries. Now, here's the interesting part about the 2600, the Expansion Module number 1. Expansion Module number 1 really needed the ColecoVision for two things: something to output video to and something to draw power off of. Well, because the steering wheel did not plug into the ColecoVision, not at least through the expansion port, it ran on batteries. Yeah, that's fun, right? Everyone likes a controller that runs on batteries. The steering wheel, despite not being analog, actually worked remarkably well. And what you ended up doing was, is you plugged in the, let's see if I can remember how this works. You plugged the racing controller into the ColecoVision's control port, and then you plugged your ColecoVision controller into the control port on the steering wheel. Because you still had to have a ColecoVision controller, right? Because you still had to be able to start a game or choose a game with the keypad, and you needed to be able to shift, because that's how Turbo worked. It was low and high gear. So that's how they did that. It was a pass-through. And there were less than 10 games that used the driving controller, as we talked about earlier, you know, what makes aftermarket controls work. But if you think about it, let's say that 10, let's just round it up to 10 and be fair. How many games did the ColecoVision have? I think it was just over 100. If you include all the PD and the shareware and the remakes of stuff afterwards, it was just over 100 if I remember right. So if 10%, 8, 9, 10% of the ColecoVision games use the driving controller, did that make it a success? I don't know. Anyway, we talked more about the Super Action Controller too. In fact, I have notes in two different places for this, and I think we pretty much covered it all. Yeah, let's talk about the roller controller, though. We talked a little bit about it. Interesting, the roller controller. It was really designed to be more of a permanent fixture to your ColecoVision. You actually had to pass the power supply for the ColecoVision through the roller controller, fascinatingly enough. No more batteries. You still had to plug the controllers in to two bays on either side of the roller controller. So the roller controller was almost like its own console. It was like the size of the ColecoVision almost. And you took the two controllers and you put them, and they had slots where you could put them. And then you had the roller controller itself. And some people said it wasn't always packed with Slither. It was also sometimes packed with the game Victory, which of course obviously used the controller if you didn't buy it originally. And it did use, as I mentioned before, some games that had accelerated movement, like war games. It had four action buttons, which was nice. And get this, it did have a selector switch in the front so that you could, say, turn the joysticks on or turn on the rollerball. So literally, they intended this unit to be plugged in full time. Obviously, if you've got the power plugged into it, you're probably not going to want to move that around all the time. By February 1983, we said by Christmas, 500,000 had been sold. February, 2 months later, and February is a short month anyway, they'd sold another 500,000. That's over a million sold. Now, Coleco, at this point in time, was strutting their stuff. Now, ColecoVision and Coleco were very famous for vaporware stuff, right? They announced a whole bunch of things that, you know, never came about. But let me tell you what they were planning. This is what they were pimping out. And don't tell me this isn't some serious next-gen crap here, okay? Check this out. The expansion module 3 was to be called the Super Game Module. They anticipated this was going to be released 6 months later, in August of 1983. It would include Super Donkey Kong, but later on they changed their mind and they said it would contain Super Buck Rogers and Super Gorf. It would add a considerable amount of system memory, and it would use these little tiny cassettes called Super Game Wafers. These promised that you would get all the arcade levels. You want the Pie Factory and Donkey Kong? You're going to get it. You want all the intermissions on Pac-Man? You're going to get it. You want to save high scores? You're going to get it, all thanks to these little micro cassettes. The unit was slated to be $120, which doesn't sound like that bad of a deal, except for that's in 1983 prices. And rumor had it, this was the rumor that freaked people out. Now remember, you got to remember, there ain't no internet. You couldn't go up and confirm or deny rumors like you can now. Literally, what you got were whisperings in the column of your monthly newsletter or your monthly magazine, maybe a little hint from a flyer that they sent you. You know, or you got it from word of mouth on the playground, for crying out loud. That's what we had. That was our internet, sneaker net. So the rumor was that it was going to use CEDs, which were essentially from a company called Spectravision. These were discs that were similar to laser discs. They weren't quite made the same way, but essentially, they looked like Laserdisc, they acted like Laserdisc, they were big record-looking things, and I actually found a couple of those available at a yard sale, Spectravision discs, and they actually showed, somebody released a picture, and I could not find it on the internet to save my life, somebody released a picture of a ColecoVision playing Dragon's Lair, right? So somebody somewhere at least was insinuating, this is before Photoshop, so somebody professional put this together. And they were showing a ColecoVision with expansion module 3 playing Dragon's Lair. Wow. They took it to some gaming shows, and just like every other company on the planet, their demos had nothing to do with the actual product. They used fake tapes to show it off, and they used ROMs, very big fat giant cartridges hiding under the table instead of actually using these little micro cassettes. Some of these super games, it's worth noting, did make their way over to the Coleco Atom, which we're going to talk about in a while. It missed its shipping date in August, and they were still working on it when, right around October, the video game crash was in full swing, and they canned the project. Now, here's something interesting you may not have known. It wasn't until the end of 1983, so the system had been out for over a year. It wasn't until the end of 1983 that Coleco allowed third-party publishers. Holy hell, when you have that kind of control, and you're making that kind of money hand over fist, and you're blocking third-party publishers for a year? Insane! And they were making so much money, it was sickening. Microfun was their first third-party developer, and if the name sounds familiar, they were responsible for not only the ColecoVision version, but also other 8-bit software versions of Miner 2049er, one of my favorite all-time platformer meets Pac-Man games. And that was indeed the first third-party title that came out for ColecoVision. Here's a little piece of random crap that I just threw in the middle of things because I thought it was interesting. If you watch the movie Firestarter with a very young Drew Barrymore, when she is, quote, incarcerated in her room at the shop's institution, Drew can be seen playing that elusive Slither game on a ColecoVision right there in her room. So there you go. There's the claim to fame, the screen time of the ColecoVision. By the very end of 1983, Coleco wanted to get into the computer business. So they took all the pieces and scraps and ideas and everything they could come up with from Expansion Unit 3, or Expansion Module 3, and they created an Atom. Now, the Atom was a big, ugly mess. There's just no other way to paint it. This thing took up a whole table, this Atom. It was a huge console with two tape drives, like cassette tape drives, right? Or was it one cassette drive? No, I think it was one. Anyway, that's where the Super Game wafers went. They went to cassette tapes. This giant-ass unit, it had a detachable keyboard, which was kind of interesting, right? A built-in word processor, a daisy wheel printer, a little bit of extra memory, and get this. It was supposed to be out by Christmas of 1983, but it didn't quite make it. They also promised it would be about $200. They did not make that. It ended up being $400. It came in a box you could probably bury your children in. It was huge. I mean, remember those old, for those of you in the UK, and there's many of you listening, do you remember like the Bat Pack and those really big rainbow bundles on the Amiga where literally you carried out a box that looked like a coffin? Yeah, that's what this came in. And, boy, this was the beginning of the end for ColecoVision, or for Coleco in general. Lots of the units were dead on arrival. You opened them up, you plugged them all in, and it just didn't work. Once you cleared off enough desk space, of course. They also brilliantly built the power supply into the printer. So if the printer wasn't plugged in, you couldn't use anything else. So the printer was the power supply. If the printer broke, the entire computer was dead. How about that? So after pushing this and just taking a complete beating, officially ColecoVision production ended in 1985, which is interesting, right? They lived another over year. During the course of their tenure, ColecoVision sold 6 million units. Absolutely insane. Now, interestingly enough, another little piece of slice of information. There's a group called Opcode Games, and you can go to opcodegames.com, or if you're watching the RGR Plus TV, I'm sure Alex is directing you there right now. They're making a real super game module for ColecoVision, and they're expecting to ship that by the end of 2012. Essentially, it's delivering on what the expansion module 3, sans the Spectrovision disc player, was supposed to put out. So anything that you read about the Super Game Module or Expansion Module 3, that's what this is going to try to do. It plugs into a real ColecoVision. It's not a standalone unit. It'll support new carts and new games. They've already got Super Donkey Kong and a Super Pac-Man. And they're pre-ordering for $70. Now, that's a little pricey, even in 2012 money, $2012. So, diehard fans really, really need to be the ones getting in on this. But it's amazing that this has come full circle. 1983 to 2012. Now, it changed hands a couple of times, right? Telegames acquired the license to a bunch of ColecoVision stuff. They produced a couple of knockoff ColecoVision units, et cetera, right? But in the end, the ColecoVision kind of died in 1985. Now, some people have made new cartridges and stuff like that, just like any other classic system. But for some 30 years later, for somebody to actually be building not a new compatible ColecoVision, right, actually creating an add-on module. This may be the first time this has ever happened. Now, it hasn't shipped yet, so maybe it hasn't happened yet. But it's very exciting. Go up there, go up and check out the screenshots and stuff of the games that they're working on. It's absolutely amazing. But is it really a ColecoVision? Is it really? You know? Is it Is it worth it? If you want to play Pac-Man, you can fire up an emulator and play the actual Pac-Man. Do you want to play Super Pac-Man that was done on an expansion module for a console you probably don't have, so you're going to go pick one up at a yard sale or from a thrift store? Well, you can't pick one up from there. eBay. You know, it's like, oh, man, that's a lot of work to play Pac-Man. I don't know. It's definitely interesting, though. And as usual, I have a couple of little stories before I wrap up this segment. The ColecoVision played a huge part in my life because one of my best friends at the time, Jim Pinto, James Pinto, had a ColecoVision. I don't know where he got it. His family was no better off than mine. We were poor, so was his family. But I think somebody in his family, extended family, was not poor. So he ended up getting a ColecoVision, I think, for Christmas of 82, if my timeline is correct. So, my goodness gracious. Just like me and Troy Tulu, or Troy Tulu and I, let's see, me playing, I play Pinto. Okay, yeah, Troy Tulu and I played Lode Runner and slept in shifts. That's what Jim Pinto and I did. I'd come over to his house to spend the weekend, because that's what you did when you were a kid, right? When you were, how old would I have been, 13? When you're that age, you go over to your friend's house and you spend the weekend with him, or at least, you know, Friday afternoon after school till, what, Saturday night? You know, if their family had something to do, they kicked you out and they went off and you went home. So we would literally play this thing in shifts. Now, he had tons of cartridges. Again, I have no idea how they afforded it. But he had Donkey Kong. He had Ladybug. He had Venture. He had Donkey Kong Jr. Let's see, what else did he have? A couple of other ones filtered through, but those were the main ones. We were so inspired, little 13, 14-year-old kids, we were so inspired by how realistic the graphics were, we decided to build a paper token dispenser. Now, this is a long time before that Kane kid came up with his paper arcade, okay? True trendsetters we were. So we created out of a box. This was amazing. I wish we had would have had digital photography back then, or at least a Polaroid or something, because I thought it was brilliant. We took a box and we made a working token machine where you put a quarter in and four little cardboard tokens came out. Now, of course, you had to reload the token machine between each quarter, but, you know, don't bother us with the details. But it did. It worked. It was a little, you know, a little fulcrum system in there, and you dropped a quarter in. It hit this thing. It was like playing mousetrap, right? Only you couldn't see the mousetrap. It hit this little thing, which hit another thing, which then flipped a cup over, and the little coins dropped out, or the little paper coins dropped out. So we had his friends come over and pay their quarter to play, you know, Donkey Kong and his sister. This was, of course, a great side note. His sister's name was Jessie. You'd think I would remember this thing. But it wasn't Jessie that was the hot one of the group. She had a friend that came over. Now, see, also, girls had sleepovers, too. So his sister would have her friend Marlene Rose come over and sleep over. And I would come over and sleep over with Jim. It's suddenly starting to sound a little gay. Not gay. Totally platonic friendship, okay? Anyway, so Marlene was, you know, I just had a huge infatuation with Marlene. I did. So she, you know, she would come out and play. They didn't care about video games. They came out to torture me. His sister came out to torture him, and Marlene came out to torture me. Because that's also what 13, 14-year-old girls do. So anyway, so that was one of the highlights of the weekend, was knowing that Marlene was coming over to spend the night. So I made sure I came over and spent the night as well. So a little slight insight to my creepy psyche, right? Anyway, so it was amazing the sort of magic that put together. You know, even today, I don't know if you can recapture that sort of thing. You know, you see things like Kane's Arcade and things like that. So there's somebody out there doing some imagination, right? But when's the last time you got a console and you and your, you know, you had a friend come over and the two of you played it until 3 o'clock in the morning and you slept for 2 hours, you got back up and you did it again? Most of us don't have that semi-charmed kind of life, if you will, anymore to do that sort of thing. So maybe kids can do that. Maybe, I don't know how kids are affording a, you know, $350 Wii U, but anyway, that's a whole other story. Maybe that still happens. I don't know. But even though there is magic to the midnight launch and new hardware and new stuff, in the end, I don't think it quite captured like what the ColecoVision did. Man, we played a lot of Donkey Kong. my hand actually starting to throb. Isn't that interesting? The memories of holding that Horde controller and playing for 5, 6, 7 hours on end, my hand's actually throbbing right now thinking about it. It's like I'm playing Kid Icarus on the 3DS. So anyway, I guess that's about all the good stories I have for ColecoVision. Jim Pinto ended up moving away and took his sister and her hot friend with her. So never really went anywhere from there. And I never owned a ColecoVision myself until much, much later on. And, of course, in my mad dash in my late 30s to regain my childhood, I went out and bought a ColecoVision. And interestingly enough, it had a bad video output. The RF was totally crapped out on it. Now, I'm not an engineer. You guys know that. I'm not a hardware kind of guy. I don't know a transistor from a diode. I wouldn't know what to do. I mean, I know a couple of basic things now, but still. So what I did was, is I went in and I cracked this sucker open, figuring, well, what the heck? I can't play it anyways. I might as well open it up and see if I can fix it. And there was a burn spot somewhere where the RF had been. I don't even know how that happened, but something told me to break out a soldering gun. Why do I have a soldering gun when I'm not an engineer guy? Don't ask. Sometimes you just have things that you shouldn't have. I have a tool belt. How often do you see me wearing a tool belt? Anyway, so somehow I managed to throw some solder somewhere and fix the damn thing. So who knows, right? Anybody, you can do magic if you're willing to throw the unit away if you mess it up. So anyway, and I believe we gave that away at a Monroe Palooza event. Somebody ended up with that because it wasn't being played, and I felt that hardware like that deserved to be played. So I gave it to somebody who I knew would make use of it and still play it. If you're the one that got my ColecoVision, let me know. I'm kind of curious who I ended up giving it out to. Well, gang, that's going to wrap it up for this month's anniversary. We talked about the ColecoVision from Coleco, circa 1982-83, up to 85, sold 6 million units, had the greatest version of Donkey Kong ever, and in fact, I believe, created the term killer app. Join us next month for another anniversary look right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, we have a huge packed bits and bytes segment for you. I think you're going to love this. First of all, we're going to start off with something cool. Now, Mortal Kombat's not exactly retro, right? But you know what? It's pretty retro. So, if nothing else, it's retro what's used to create this. Now, this is, let me make sure I get the proper, I'm kind of going out of order here a little bit. I wanted to start with this because I got all inspired. Dana Eiler sent this in. In fact, like 90% of this month's news comes from Dana Eiler and myself. Appreciate that, Dana. You always, you know, fighting the good fight. First up, now many of you have heard disk drives make noise, especially if you grew up in the Commodore 64 realm. Am I right? Clicking, scratching, knocking noises. And then somebody thought, you know, based on the rotation and the way the heads move and all that stuff, you could actually get almost a, you could actually make it play music. So people have had disk drives that spin and make sounds, right? So these guys, this is Mr. Solid Snake 745. I'm going to give him a good plug. This guy does a ton of these, quote, themes on disk drives. This is the Mortal Kombat theme played on 8 floppy disk drives. Now, this isn't going to come over very well over the microphone, but I'm going to do my best anyway because I think it's worth... It's not so detailed that I think it'll be lost when I mix the show down. You just have to hear a couple of seconds of this. And again, you're going to have access to it, by the way, over on RetroGamingRadio.com. Go look at the show details, and you'll see links to all the videos and all that good stuff. Anyway, listen to some of this. This is great. Okay, don't tell me that's not the coolest thing ever. This guy does tons of other stuff. Here's Ghostbusters. Check this out. That's art. This guy should go on America's Got Talent. Isn't that the best ever? All right, that's enough of that. All right, you get the idea. So, yeah, check that out. That's fantastic. What a great find, you know. I'm glad I don't have to do that with any of my disk drives. But it's fun when someone else does it. All right, there's a guy working on a documentary, Vector Invader, is working on this. Let's see, what's the guy's actual name? David Denzera, I'll read you the promo for this so that you get an idea. And there's a trailer I'm going to give you. It's an 8-minute trailer. And this film seeks to show that many aspects of today's gaming scene are firmly rooted in the arcade culture of the 1980s. And he believes for this film to fulfill its destiny, it must focus not only on the games, but the arcades themselves, and the arcade games, or the arcades themselves, but on the actual people who were the first to embrace the worldwide game video culture. Capturing their memories and feelings on film as an oral history for future generations to study. This film in particular documents the lives and shared memories of the classic arcade collectors who grew up in the arcade. So they've got a whole teaser. I don't have any specific release dates on here. They give you tons of links that you can check out to get more information. I definitely recommend you take a look. I did get a chance to see this trailer. It's very interesting. So check that out. I believe that was pretty much, unless I tell you different, Dana Eiler sent these in. It was a busy Dana Eiler. Dana doesn't have anything else to do, I guess, but that's great for me because, you know, while I contribute a lot, he contributed more. There's rumor mill that Twin Galaxies, the world record scoreboard that has been around, gosh, long time. I was briefly a part of that group handling Commodore 64 scores. That's way too much work, folks. If you ever get a knock on your door by, you know, Walter Day or somebody that says, hey, would you like to handle console X or computer X? Say no. No. Otherwise, your house will be flooded with VHS cassette tapes. Maybe not anymore, not VHS, but yeah. Anyway, so there's rumor mill going around that 1UP, the gaming web entity, has purchased or is somehow involved with Twin Galaxies. I'm not sure. I'm super excited about that. But hey, what can I tell you? I just pass on the news. I'm not here to stand judgment. Well, on this maybe. I'm always interested in great coffee table books. Oddly enough, I do not have a coffee table. And when I do have a coffee table out, there's no books on it. But hot off the trails of his first book, Gozer 5454 continues his trek through the arcade kingdom in search of the mightiest games to ever capture the industry's hearts. These are the forgotten classics of yesteryear, the cherished games of the arcade past. These are the grails. And this is to be a about a $50 hardcover book. And the nice thing is that they let you preview it. And you get 21 pages of previews, which is really generous. So go check it out and see if this guy's stuff is to your liking. This would be the sort of thing that if I did have a coffee table and I put books on it, this would totally be on here. I mean, within the first few pages, you're seeing an original Major Havoc machine. You're seeing Quantum, Venture, Berserk, video games that have pinballs in them like Baby Pac-Man. Nibbler, Q-Bert, oh, I love Nibbler, Satan's Hollow, Cosmic Alien, I guess I'm going to go through all of these because I'm all entranced, Cube Quest, Snake Pit. Now, each one of these pages has, like, one of the collectors, it looks like the collector dressed up in some costume sometimes, with his machine, and then it has screenshots along the bottom and then a small write-up. It's absolutely perfect for what I would consider a coffee table book. And I guess that's pretty much it. Okay, so there you go. Very cool. God, I'm going to see if I can get myself one of these. $50 is kind of hard to part with, but you know what? It looks really cool. Okay, next up. Remember we were talking in the ColecoVision article earlier, the segment we were talking about how it's pretty common for people to be writing games, new games for old hardware. Well, the 2600 seems to be one of the biggest known entities for creating new games for. And Dana Eiler produces this for us. This individual, I do not have his actual name. His name is Quad Runner. And Quad Runner is creating an actual accurate-looking Atari 2600 version of Asteroids called Space Rocks. This I did get around to playing because I had to take a look before I did the show. I played it on the 2600.emu from Robert Broglia, you know, the guy that makes the most awesome emulators for mobiles and tablets. And I gotta say, it's really good. I mean, if you're a 2600 head or an Asteroids head, you've got to pick it up. It runs on Stella. They've got it running on the Harmony hardware. Obviously, it runs in various other 2600 emulators. I can't recommend it enough, especially, again, if you're big into 2600 and you really love seeing what Asteroids can be real. I mean, what it would look like if they had today's technology and today's free time, I think. Okay, next up here. We have, now here's an interesting thing. We got a lot of people who are interested in building their own arcade cabinet. And, well, because these things cost a fortune to actually go out and buy one. And when I say arcade cabinet, typically I mean a main cabinet where you can load up a computer, put it inside of an arcade cabinet, hook up some actual controls to it, right? An actual arcade control panel, hook it up to the, computer and actually play the games using as realistic controls as possible while playing the most realistic emulated versions possible, right? So main cabinets are big. And there are plenty of companies that for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 will build you a dream machine. A lot of people would rather go and do it themselves, right? They'll go to like an auction, and they'll pick up an old JAMA cabinet, you know, a really generic cabinet that's got a nice monitor in it. So then they're tasked with taking and hooking that monitor somehow up to a PC. Not as easy as it sounds. Then they have to be tasked with hooking those controls up that are, you know, their arcade controls, and hooking those up to the PC somehow, right? And there's all sorts of different ways of doing it. Now, I'm going to pass you on Brian King, big friend of the show, longtime friend of mine. Brian King runs a website called ArcadeRestoration.com. If you are interested in doing anything like this, working with an arcade cabinet of any kind, whether you're restoring it or doing anything, this is your first stop. This guy has spent, what was the opening date of this thing? Does he have this on here? 1998, so do the math. 2008. So he's been at this like almost, 12, 13, 14 years, and all of his information's on here. And I have word from a little bee, a little bird flew over and said that there's a new version, a brand new, fully tricked out version of Arcade Restoration coming soon. And believe me, I've had a chance to take a look at it. Okay, it wasn't a little bird. Brian told me he has a new version, and I got a chance to look at it. You're going to be blown away. If you frequent this site a lot for your arcade restoration needs, and if you don't, you should, this is the guy to go see. So ArcadeRestoration.com, Brian King, great guy. So let's go back to my original thought process here, which was, how do you get those controls hooked up to a PC? Right? There's a whole subnet of categories of dealing how to get a Gardner monitor to hook up to a PC. Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about getting the controls mapped up. Some people go so far, get this, some people will take a USB joystick, okay, tear it apart down to the board, solder wires onto the proper locations, and then wire that up to the control panel. Huge pain in the butt, very delicate, very time consuming. I've actually seen horror stories of this on the internet. And worse yet, when you do these sort of homebrew put-togethers, they have the some of the problems known as ghosting or delays, whereas you move right and it takes just a fraction of a second for it to get registered through the joystick into your PC and hence make your player move. So, this guy, Vigo, the Scourge of Carpathia, that's actually his avatar here. this guy is selling something called the Zero Delay Arcade Controller Encoder. Now, anybody who's been shopping for these things know that these things are usually pricey and a pain in the butt to get a hold of. And they're usually not that great a quality. These look really good. Now, I'm not an electrician here, so I don't know. But it looks very nice, and I'm not an engineer. Damn it, Jim. Anyway, these look very, very good. And the controls are encoded like a gamepad. It's already got wires and stuff for you. It looks absolutely fantastic. And I'm trying to find out what the price was, but I saw it, and it's like, no friggin' way. I mean, I think he was wanting, like, yeah, $15. $15! I mean, if you've ever, I mean, and look at, you gotta see the picture. When you go to the site, you gotta see the picture of how these things all plug in. It's absolutely crazy. It's beautiful. So anyway, if you're in the market for something like that, your prayers have been answered, because that's just absolutely fantastic. That's also compliments of Dana Eiler. Thank you. Jonathan Doyen sends in a neat, unfortunately ended eBay auction. This last year, they had a very brief run of Hot Wheel cars, but they were all styled as video games, right? So there is a Hot Wheels Tempest car. There's a Hot Wheels, what were some of the other ones? Pong, Hot Wheels Centipede, a Missile Command truck, a Breakout truck. They're very cool. Anyway, they just sold for about $32. For a, looks like a, six of them. There's six different ones. So, keep your eyes open. You hit the thrift stores. You hit the yard sales. You know, these are actually worth a couple of bucks, and they look pretty cool. I remember seeing these, and I thought, oh, you know, I should pick those up. And then by the time I thought about it again, they were gone. So, you snooze, you lose. Andrew Driver, also a regular contributor, sends in an interesting article. Behind the scenes of making Sega Rally. This is another Japanese name. I'm totally going to butcher this. Tetsuya Mizuguchi, best known for his musically inclined titles such as Space Channel 5 and Rez. Designer rose to fame thanks to a different kind of sound, the roar of an engine and the cry of game over. Yeah! Well, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so this is an article talking about the behind the scenes of making that title. Interesting read if you are a Sega Rally fan. Gary Adamson, another regular contributor, sends us a sad note. It's always sad when classic video game designers pass away. I know the guy's name too. It's funny, but I didn't really play any of his games. Mike Singleton. He's known for the games Lords of Midnight and Domark's Revenge, along with a ton of other titles. I had to look him up on Moby Games to get a list of some of the other ones. But he was a very classically trained video game designer and programmer, and he lost his battle with cancer, and that's really sad. So anyway, take a moment and thank him for his contribution in your mind. However, he also was involved in Midwinter, which has got to be, I'll take a quick moment here and give this guy some love. I'm sure Mike Singleton didn't write the manual for Midwinter. Whoever did, genius. I've never been more, if you can find Midwinter like on eBay or something for a couple of bucks, buy it, but throw the game out. You don't need the game because the game not that good. But the book that comes with it is like a novella, and it talks about, it's in the form of a top secret document about how ice ages happen and how we can artificially create one. Unbelievably interesting reading. You might even be able to find a PDF of it kicking around the internet. We'll see what we can find out for you. But Midwinter, I played the game for 2 seconds and said this sucks. But the manual, I read 5 or 6 different times. It's absolutely amazing. Let's see. Oh, yes. Jonathan Doyen also sends in one of my favorite games is about to be slaughtered yet again. And this is an Xbox version. It's going to be out, it looks like, on PlayStation 3 and Wii U as well. They're taking one of the classic Jordan Mechner titles, however you decide you want to pronounce it, Karateka or Karateka. I call it Karateka because, as you know, this is an old story of the show, but some of you are new listeners. No, it's Karateka. Jordan Mechner said it himself. Well, listen, Jordan Mechner needs to contact his ad people. Because when the ads for this game played on television, and you can still find these ads, they're on YouTube, when the ads ran, the announcer called it Karateka. When that's the first thing, the first time you see the game, and the first time you hear the game's name, and it's on frickin' network television and they call it Karateka, you call it Karateka for the rest of your life. It's just the way it is. I don't care what it's supposed to be called. That's what they advertise it as. That's what I call it. Anyway, that is coming. First screens are now available. It looks very much like sort of almost like a, what's the style? Sort of a Tekken look to it. This is being produced by Liquid Entertainment, published by D3. So hopefully this will be a cheap downloadable title. Up and coming HD remake, blah, blah, blah. You can read more about it. But anyway, it's always fun to negotiate about how to say the game's name. Next up, I'm going to give Dana Eiler credit for this, even though I also submitted it to myself. A full-size, working Kinect pinball machine. Kinects are those kind of like the successors to Lincoln Logs, you know, or Tinker Toys, but they're like for men, you know, men play with Kinects, kids play with Tinker Toys, same idea. Anyway, this guy's got a full-size working pinball machine made out of Kinect parts. It's just something you have to see. I can't explain it. All I know is that I don't have enough free time to even consider building something like this, even if I had the engineering ability, which I do not. But hey, I'm glad that people have, you know, hobbies that don't involve, you know, holding me up at gunpoint. Let's see here. This is... Next up is the Golden Age Arcade book. And I don't have very generous notes on this. It looks like this guy runs a blog. He calls himself the Golden Age Arcade Historian. And it looks like they're building a book. I can't tell if they've actually got one or not. Anyway, today's post is an excerpt from the chapter on Laserdisc games in my book. This section covers the two games made by Laserdisc Computer Systems. Much of the info comes from an interview I did with Michael Harris in October 2001. So it looks like there's a book somewhere, but, you know, they're using this blog, and I can't... There's no place to buy it or to see the book or... I don't know. But anyway, it looks like there's just absolutely tons and tons and tons of interesting stuff on this blog for any sort of arcade historian. So you'll want to check that out. Let's see. We did the Mortal Kombat theme already. Peter Oatley sent in an interview with John Hare of Sensible Software. I know my computer's going nuts. I get one text message and like everything on my desk fires up. What can I tell you? Okay, so here we go. This is an interview. Now see, Sensible Software was not a big deal to me. I know it was huge in the UK, and to somewhat say that Sensible Software was not the greatest thing on the planet, it offends my UK listeners. However, I'm gonna say Sensible Software was not my favorite development company. I didn't care for Sensible Soccer. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not a technically good game. I'm just saying I don't care about soccer. So there was many things about Sensible Software I didn't care about. However, let's see. This guy is responsible for classics such as Whizball. I did like Whizball. Sensible Soccer. And who didn't like Cannon Fodder? Everybody liked Cannon Fodder. But, you know, Sensible Soccer, Sensible World of Soccer, it's like, I don't care. Anyway, so here's an interview with John Hare. Obviously too long for me to read to you, but any interview with classic developers, I'm definitely down with. I know most of you are too. I'm not sure if I was going to put this one in or not. A lot of people are big into the rogue and hack type games. Who isn't, right? Peter Oatley also sent in this thing called Faster Than Light, and it is a game. It's a modern game. But it has, let me see if there's a plug in here that I could properly. This is called a spaceship simulation, real time roguelike. It is, supposedly available now. Yes, you can buy it. And, let's see. If you watch the video, let me see here. Let me give you their self explained right from their FAQ. FTL is a spaceship simulation roguelike. Its aim is to recreate the atmosphere of running a spaceship exploring the galaxy like Firefly, Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica. In any given episode of these classic shows, the captain is always yelling, reroute power to the shields, or giving commands to the engineer now that their warp core is on fire. We wanted that experience as opposed to dogfighting in space that most video games focus on. We wanted a game where we had to manage the crew, fix the engines, route the power to shields, target the enemy life support, and then figure out how to repel the boarders that just transported over. So that sounds like a pretty good game. I mean, I might play that. The videos look fun. It looks like an old school game. Some of you may remember from Classic Retro Gaming Radio, I reviewed a game called Sci-Fi Trading Company, which sounds a lot like this. In Sci-Fi Trading Company, it's pure management. And if you haven't had an opportunity to play this, that game gets freaking insane. I bet this game plays a lot like it. I mean, it doesn't play the same, but it's kind of got the same objective. In Sci-Fi, you pick your crew. And you have, you know, weapons officer, communications officer. So you have these, what do you call them? You know, you have these department leaders. And they're the ones that do the work. You also have, like, work droids to assign to do repairs. So depending on how difficult of a mission you choose, you have to get from A to B with certain cargo, right? Some cargo can be damaged. Some cargo can be lost. There's all sorts of little parameters around that. But anyway, so the game concept there was you have a ship filled with cargo. You got to get from A to B. The ship kind of flies on autopilot. However, if you lose your engines, the ship will stop. If you get damaged, the ship will stop. These sort of things, right? So you've got, you put these players in place that are supposed to be your generals in the on the ship to handle communications, to handle life support, and they all have very distinct personalities. So if you put a real gonad in charge of communications, when you need something, when you're in the heat of battle and you need comms right now, he's going to sweat and fret and he's going to roll over on himself instead of hooking you up. But you got to put these guys in the right spot. Anyway, and then of course you've got the task of managing damage control. So it's like, what do you try to get back online first? Your engines, your weapons. So when something goes down, you have to assign robots to them to go fix them. You know, when the robots take a certain amount of time to fix, and you've got to prioritize. It's really cool. And this sounds a lot like Sci-Fi Trading Company, only sort of a, like an overhead view. Anyway, check out the video. If it sounds even remotely interesting to you, I mean, why not give the guy, I think he wants $10 for it, right? Let's see, yeah, $10. And what's this thing available on? Windows, Mac, and Linux. Hey, Linux people, you get a game. It's on Steam and Good Old Games. Well, I recommend going to Good Old Games. No DRM, no server-side checks, blah, blah, blah. You download it, you own it. I love it. Next up, oh, this just pisses me off because I want one of these so bad. Somebody took an Android tablet and what appears to be, I think they made this fresh. This is an arcade machine, a mini micro, it's almost like a little cabaret or a desktop arcade machine. Made out of Android and a fighting stick. Oh, just go check out the video. You'll be drooling. He's playing all these cool games. It's got a great fighting pad. The game looks fantastic. It's just the right size. Makes me want one bad. And of course, you can't buy one. You know, you'd pay $200 for something like that, but you can't get one. Now, I have not listened to this, but it comes from a reliable source, me. So I guess maybe I probably should have listened to this. I tend not to plug or promote other podcasts unless I have an opportunity to hear. Because, you know, this is sort of, I try to keep this show, my passenger seat radio show, I can get filthy and talk about bad things and say bad words. But I try to keep this show safe for work, you know, safe for my younger listeners, which I do have a considerable number of. So I try not to plug other podcasts unless I've listened to them and make sure that I can, you know, attest that they're not going to upset you. But anyway, so this podcast is called BitFella's BitJam Podcast, and the reason that they're getting a shout out in this episode is because they do a tribute to Psygnosis, which we did just the other day. So again, I apologize. I would not listen to that podcast at work just in case. I don't know anything about it. But anybody who's giving Psygnosis their due deserves me to plug them. Next up, also from me, Prince of Persia Classic has arrived, at least on the Android platform. I'm assuming it's on iOS as well. This is essentially the same old game, but it looks fantastic. It looks beautiful. It's, you know, I picked it up. Anytime, you know, these guys are putting this sort of old stuff together, Let's see. They do have a couple of... They have different game modes. They have normal mode, that you don't have to worry about time or death penalty. Time attack, where you race against the sands of time as you navigate through levels, fighting the guards. Find the exit. You only have 60 minutes, which is a lot like the old one. The most compelling and challenging way is survival, which is, I think this is the old one. Complete the game in 60 minutes without dying. Ah. So you got a couple different ways. You got to look at the screenshots. Check out the video. It looks great. You know, for the people who really want a good-looking game as well as a good playing game, that's it's hard to beat that. Let's see. We're getting close to the end here. The iCade Core comes from BJ Wundland, a big fan of the show. And now I'm a little confused on this. This is called the iCade Core. It's from Ion, who makes a lot of Apple-related products, but a lot of their stuff ends up being Bluetooth, so it can work on Android. This shows an iPad stuck inside a tabletop controller featuring 8 buttons and a joystick. And it says that it connects using Bluetooth wireless technology. No cables, no mess. But at the same time, it says it's got a cable pass-through slot to allow you to charge while you play. So I'm assuming there's like a 30-pin connector in that slot. So if you wanted to put your Android tablet on here, you'd probably have to remove that. But if it's Bluetooth, then it should play fine, right? If it's Bluetooth, it should sync right up and show up as an iCade, and you should be able to play it. It's $80, which is a little pricey. And it does, oh, and it takes 2 AA batteries. So there you go. So that probably drives the Bluetooth. They don't mention Android anywhere on here. Most of the time they, you know, and Android, you know, they put some little thing at the end, but not here. But this looks like fun. It's got, I don't know how big the slot is or anything. I'd actually have to see one on display and take my tablet and throw it in there and see if it would work. But hey, for those of you who are into iOS, this might be useful to you. $80 though, that's pricey. My goodness. Now here's something I don't understand, but I'm going to share it with you. This is something also sent in by BJ Wundland. This is called the Hitbox Arcade. This is an arcade-style controller, large and in charge. The thing's huge. It looks like it fits on your desktop. It's got arcade-quality buttons, but it has no joysticks. Yeah, it has no joysticks, but it's all buttons. And the videos that they show, I briefly had a chance to look into it because I'm trying to get my hands around the concept of a controller that has no joystick on it. Or D-pad. D-pad, I would understand. No D-pad. So this thing is an arcade controller that's got like 16 buttons on it and no controller. Just buttons. And apparently this is good for fighting games. They show some guy using it for fighting games and he's whooping butt, but you know, I don't know. Maybe someone else can explain it to me. Maybe somebody's got one of these things and can hook me up. BJ Wundland also sends in another interview with Pitfall creator David Crane. And the only reason I bring this up, because we have like 9 billion other interviews with David Crane, including mine, which I do feel is superior. This goes back to a lot of his, like, way, way back past. I mean, like, you know, how did you get from, you know, your first gig repairing radios to doing this, you know? So it's got a lot of old school information where most of his interviews have, you know, after you wrote Pitfall, then what happened? So there you go. And finally, I'm going to end this with a plea. Most of you know I'm a huge fan of the game Deluxe Galaga. Now, I alluded to this a bit in the intro, but I know some of you skipped the intro, so I'm going to take up some of your time now. Deluxe Galaga on the Amiga platform, in my opinion, is the definitive space shooter. Not Galaga 90 or Galaga 88, depending on how you played it. Great games. Nothing touches Deluxe Galaga. Two-player cooperative mode, unbelievable secrets. The game is loaded with hidden Easter eggs, all sorts of weaponry. In my opinion, Deluxe Galaga is the space shooter perfected. Okay, I've always thought so. Now, since the Amiga is no longer around, and it's kind of a pain to get working in emulation, especially if you don't know how to build hard drive images and all that stuff. If you want the full-blown Deluxe Galaga AGA experience with full sound and full speech, you got to install it to a hard drive, yada yada. It's a pain. However, Edgar Vidgel, the guy that created that and Deluxe Pac-Man and a couple of other games, he changed over and started creating a game for the PC called Warblade. Now, Deluxe Galaga obviously didn't want to get sued. You can make a game on the Amiga back then and call it anything you want. You can make it, you could actually call it Donkey Kong and nobody would care because nobody's looking at the Amiga, right? So he got away with Deluxe Galaga. But when he moved to the PC, he smartly changed the name to Warblade. To me, it's always going to be Deluxe Galaga. You can call it Warblade all you want. Well, the problem was, and I'm still a believer in this, Warblade is a Super Whamadyne Deluxe graphical version of Deluxe Galaga. It's essentially the same game, only updated with new graphics. The problem isn't with the graphics being too good, which they're very nice. It's a problem with the resolution, right? On an Amiga, you're talking like 320 by 200. So when you shoot a shot, you hit the button once and a shot goes off, it takes X amount of time to get from the bottom of the screen to the top of the screen. If you're in, you know, 2048 by 1680 resolution, the shot takes a lot longer to get to the top. How the enemies descend on you is different. The whole game, while the game looks and sounds like the original game, it doesn't play like the original game. So I kind of sat out Warblade. I played it a little bit, but I wasn't very excited about it until I started thinking about playing Warblade on a new lower resolution device like a cell phone or a tablet. That would make sense to put that there. Unfortunately, the only devices that Edgar supported were Apple devices, which you know I'm not an Apple fan. I don't own any. I wasn't planning on getting one to play Warblade on. And plus, let's be honest, playing Warblade with a touchscreen would suck. I don't care how many people wrote me and said, no, Warblade's fine on the iPhone. No, it's not. If you're not playing with a joystick, you're not playing Warblade right. So anyway, now Edgar's got a new project called Warblade Mark II. Now, what makes this project different? Well, first of all, the biggest difference is he's using the Unity engine, which means it can be ported to practically anything. That means I'm going to get my Android version. And because I know Edgar, if I tell him that there's something wrong with the Android version, he'll fix it. If there's a problem with the controls, I know that he'll be empathetic and fix it for me. Now, he wants Warblade MK2 to be something special. I get it. Remember I talked earlier about me wanting to start a Kickstarter project to make the Decades Collection of Retro Gaming Radio special? He wants to make Warblade Mark II a commercial quality game, from the graphics to the music to the sound. He wants to use the Unity engine in full. Now, those of you who code using Unity know that that ain't cheap. And every module costs you money. Out of the box, they'll run on PC, but then you got to add modules to run on Android, modules to run on iOS, blah, blah, blah. It costs a lot of bank. So he is kickstarting this using, I don't know what the name of this site is, Ulule, something like that. Anyway, it's basically Kickstarter. Kickstarter won't let anybody outside the country make a Kickstarter project. Okay? So he couldn't use Kickstarter like everybody else, so he's using this other one. My goal, once I realized he was doing a Kickstarter, my goal has been to get him fully funded. I personally threw $50 at him. $50 is a very minuscule price to pay for all the time I've had with Deluxe Galaga. It's a pittance. It is a pittance price to pay to get Deluxe Galaga on the Android. I'd pay that right now. If he said, here's Deluxe Galaga on the Android or Warblade on the Android, $50 please, thank you. I'd be paying it. So I donated $50 and I've challenged everybody I know, some of you who follow me on Twitter, either Shane R. Monroe or Retro Gaming Radio at Twitter, or you follow me on Google Plus, or you're just following the websites and all that, then you're seeing that I'm really pushing hard to get this funded. I want this funded like nobody's business. Now, the good news is apparently I have some pull. You know, a lot of people say, no one listens to Retro Gaming Radio. Well, apparently they do. Nobody follows you on Google Plus. Well, apparently somebody does. And nobody apparently follows me on Twitter because I only have 144 followers. So let's change that. Okay, my task, in addition to supporting Warblade Mark II, please, for God's sakes, let me get some more followers on Twitter, okay? 144 is pathetic. So let's get some more followers on Twitter, okay? Thank you so much. Anyway, so back to this Kickstarter fund. I challenge everybody. I donated $50. Right? And it doesn't show that. It shows me on the supporter list, but it doesn't show how much I donated. $50. For $50 in this Kickstarter project, here's what you get. First, you get his Eternal Gratitude. Now, that's huge. You get a digital copy of the game. You get a digital copy of the soundtrack. Your name appears in the eco-founder section of the game. You get a real Warblade Mark II postcard with thanks from Edgar on it. Access to the beta versions of his next game product. Early access to new versions of the game levels and level packs. And some sort of a super account on his server. I don't know what that means, but that sounds like a deal. If all you want's the game, you can get down to $15. No, $10. $10 will buy you a digital copy of the game. From there, it just goes up in goodies and in price. So there you go. $50 is the Admiral prize. For $100, let's see what $100 gets you. I wasn't going to put $100. I mean, I love Edgar and all that, but digital copy of the game, soundtrack, co-founder section, postcard, beta. Oh, you get your own personal data capsule added to the game. What does that mean? Hang on, I might throw the extra 50 in here. Hang on. Oh, geez. Personal data capsule. This is a game object that will spread out across space when a player collects it and show the info stored inside the capsule. This will be a photo of you and some other info about you and a message from you. I can also put links into web pages, Facebooks, or other links. This will be a time capsule stored in the game for players to find and collect over the time to come. Oh, hell. Ugh. I'm gonna have to up my thing. I'm gonna have to up it. I'm gonna have to have my own capsule. Dang it, that's way cool. A time capsule hidden inside the game? I'm gonna part with another $50. Alright, anyway, so back to, forget my lamenting here. Support the Kickstarter. It's got 38 days left. It's 84% funded. Obviously I have some pull left still, folks, because I started plugging the thing. And within like an hour, they were like 23% funded. Okay, so you guys are out there pulling for us, helping me to help him, to help you, to help me, to help him, or something like that. So do me a favor, go in there, give him $10. That's all I'm saying. You don't have to give him 50. If you want to give him 50, great. If you want that personal capsule, I've got to get in on that. Anyway, if you want more, you can donate more, but please help get this thing funded. If I don't have a copy of Warblade on my Android before the end of the year, I'm going to lose my freaking mind. All right, well, listen, now that you've had my personal plea, the last thing I have for you, a lot of you are collectors. A lot of you are Nintendo collectors from the old days. Right now, Burger King is getting, selling with their kids' meal, right? They have toys, and they're all related to Mario and or the new Wii U. Now, a lot of you, who cares about the Wii U? I got it. It's a classic gaming show. However, if you're collectors of Mario, there's a rolling Koopa shell that rolls by itself. You got a Mario that you can pose. Listen to this. Here's the other one that they've got. If you can find it. They've got a little Wii U game pad, but that's, who cares about that? Inside is like this black goo. And you take the goo, and in the back there's a mold for a Mario mustache. So forget the black goo. Let's say you want to use Play-Doh, whatever. Who knows what's in that black goo? Anyway, so you push this goo into this mold, and then you flop it out, you know, like a Play-Doh mold, and there's a Mario mustache. I've got pictures. I'll share if you guys like. So anyway, point being is you might want to pick those up if you're a diehard collector. Me, I'm picking up two of each. One stays sealed in the bag. The other one's to play with. So, well, gang, I hope you enjoyed Bits and Bytes. Remember, most of this news comes from you, or Dana Eiler in this case. Please send it into bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com, and you may hear your news story read right here on the air. Join us next month for more Bits and Bytes right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, folks, it is October, and so we are going to focus on some of the games that scared the bejesus out of me as a kid. And now, let's be honest. Now, what is a scary game, right? I guess that's sort of subjective, right? Some things are more scary to some people than others. In some cases, some people are scared by prose, right? I mean, you could be playing The Lurking Horror, an Infocom game, and get the bejesus scared out of you. Likewise, it may take a visual cue, like Friday the 13th on the C64 to scare you. But let's be honest, one of the things that makes something scary, typically speaking from a psychological point of view, the things that scare people the most are things that could possibly be real. As soon as you exit a certain air of fantasy, it becomes ludicrous, or it becomes funny that you've gone beyond, above and beyond what could possibly happen. Unfortunately, in one case, when it comes to graphics, this is one area where graphics definitely help convey fear, right? It's hard to be afraid of 8-bit blood and 8-bit gore and 8-bit scare tactics. However, it's not impossible to scare somebody, even with an Atari 2600 or a VIC-20. So, let's go through the games. Now, I'm sure there are more kicking around. These are the ones that I identified as having some sort of a visceral impact on my psyche. And again, understand my history, right? I'm a Commodore guy. I didn't own a lot of consoles growing up. So, obviously, most of these games are going to be pulled from there. And a lot of people are probably not going to agree with me, but that's okay because this is Shane's scary game list. I'd love to know what games scared the bejesus out of everybody else. So feel free to comment in and add your two cents. We're going to go roughly in historical order here. One of the first games that I remember really giving me the creeps was a Scott Adams adventure game on cartridge for the VIC-20 called The Count. And this was not my first adventure into text or prose-based games. I played a lot of them on the TRS-80 Model 3. But this was the first one that I remember really giving me the creeps, right? I was up in my room. Oh, this is on Columbia Street, by the way, for those of you who listen to my Passenger Seat Radio show, which was scary enough anyway. But I was, you know, you're upstairs, and you're all alone. Everyone's asleep. The lights are off, and you're getting told about, you know, getting bit by a vampire. So, you know, I can't remember what my age was at the time. I'd have to be in my, you know, either my tweens or early teens. So The Count was definitely a good piece of scary fun. The next one that really, really scared the crap out of me was a type-in game from, I believe it was Compute Magazine, not Compute Gazette, but Compute Magazine. Because this was available for, like, every platform on the planet. It was called Goodbye Charlie. Does anybody remember this game other than me? Goodbye Charlie, it was crazy. The goal of the game was to get from one end of a cemetery to the other. This was a top-down view, and you were a ball, a little circle, right? This is top-notch graphics here. You had to, and you used the arrow keys on the keyboard to move the ball across the playing field, which was supposed to be a cemetery, and the gravestones were marked with a box, right? I mean, this is high, top-notch production values here. The cool part is that it was almost like a maze. You had to get from A to B, which was the top of the screen. You started at the bottom. And you had to get there without running into a tombstone. If you did, the game made this horrifying lightning strike sound, flashed the screen, and you were dead. So I just want to try to impart the tension. Oh, did I mention you can't see the headstones? Okay, so at the beginning of the game, they flash a lightning bolt a couple of times and they light up the play field. So you're trying to memorize where all the tombstones are. Then the whole screen goes dark, except for you. So you're sitting here lightly touching the keys, hoping to God you don't run into one of these tombstones, right? So you're trying to remember from memory, you know, trying to bring back from memory how to get, you know, where the tombstones were so you could carefully get your ball from one side of the screen to the other. Now, you did have a cheat. You could call a lightning strike, like once or twice per level, something like that, that would let you, you know, reaffirm where the tombstones were. I remember turning all the lights off. I had the glowing 1702 monitor in front of me. I had the sound cranked all the way up. And it seems to me it didn't make like a heartbeat sound, but it made some sort of a quiet, repetitive noise while you were waiting as you're moving. Right? And then as soon as you were, you know, as soon as you hit the tombstone, boom, you know, scare the living crap out of you. What a game. I mean, this was a typing game. You type this in from code in the back of the magazine, and you played it. It was basically for free with your purchase of the magazine. Goodbye, Charlie. I should see if there's a flash port or something of that on the web that I could share with you guys. That'd be pretty cool. Next up is probably the original consummate horror game for the Commodore 64. Known as Forbidden Forest. Paul Norman, we've had him on the show. Great guy. I love him. He's a very demented individual. If you've ever seen any of his more modern work, you understand. Well, heck, most of his work. His games appear twice on this list. The first one, of course, being Forbidden Forest. Now, I know what you're thinking. How scary can a Commodore 64 game be? Well, this was a creepy frickin' game. And this really is a testament to developers of the time, of the era, because not everybody could elicit fear using 8-bit graphics and 8-bit sound effects, right? I mean, that's, you've got to give credit where credit's due. Forbidden Forest featured a third-person view of an archer. You're an archer running through the forest. You're fixed in the center of the screen, and you run left and right, and the forest scrolls around you. You tap your button, and it draws an arrow out of your quiver, and then you're prepared to shoot. A number of different levels are in the game. The first one has literally giant-ass spiders chasing after you. And these are actually kind of scary-looking. I don't know how you do it with 8-bit graphics, but the man did it. So these giant spiders come after you. The next level have these skeletons with spears coming after you. Another level has a giant snake head rising up out of the forest. I mean, it looked good. Spitting venom at you. Another one had giant bees, or were they frogs? Oh no, they were frogs. Giant stomping frogs that would fly up from behind the forest and then fly onto the screen really fast and stomp on you. There was a giant bee, and then my favorite was this scary, frickin' hooded ghost thing that hid behind the trees. And the only way that you could kill this thing was to shoot an arrow into his head, into the face of the mask of this shrouded bad guy, and it screamed. When you hit this thing in the head, it screamed. Not a digitized scream, but some sort of a harmonic sound based on the C64 SID chip that it's like a chalkboard, you know, like the sound of fingers on a chalkboard that just make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. This is the same thing. And then, of course, the Demogorgon or the Demon Gorgon at the end, that was the same sort of thing as Goodbye Charlie. The thing was hiding in the horizon, and you could only see it when lightning struck. And you had to shoot not only left to right, but this one also required some faction of up and down, right, where you had to kind of aim. And this thing got bigger the closer it got to you. I'm telling you, it was freaky as hell. Probably one of my favorite scary games of all time, right, is Forbidden Forest. Because it really was a production. It was an 8-bit production. It was one of the first times I'd ever seen a video game turned not into a movie, but something that could elicit that sort of fear. Good stuff, right? If you never played it. Next up of Paul Norman's games, which gave me the creeps, was a game called Caverns of Kafka. This had you playing an Indiana Jones type guy going through these giant, scary caverns. And the caverns had all sorts of nasties involved. But your goal was to walk around these caverns and pick up these five enchanted stones, if you will. And then you had to take the stones one at a time back to this idol and put the stones into the idol face. And these stones were all random, so you never knew where they were going to be. And the game, there was a couple of kind of bugs or glitches in the game, which sort of took away the fun factor of it. But what would be cool is when you died, let's say you fell off the side of the cliff or a rock hit you in the head or whatever, you would fall, it would play this creepy music, you would fall, and when you hit the ground, finally, eventually, as soon as you hit the ground, you would skeletonize. And again, it's 8-bit graphics, folks, so you gotta kinda use your imagination. But the music and the presentation was just frickin' creepy. And then when you did unlock the idol, and you went into the treasure room, again, it had this creepy music with these screams going on. It was just crazy. And you could see all this stuff on YouTube. Look for Long Play for some of these games and you'll see it. Now, of course, the next obvious game that you have to talk about is Friday the 13th, also on the C64, although it did get ported to other games. What made this game creepy was the shock value, right? Well, that's what Friday the 13th was about, shock value. In this game, you were running around trying to stay away from getting killed by Jason Voorhees. Every time, well, not every time, that was the cool part. Sometimes, when Jason took out one of your friends, a giant, huge, I mean, for a Commodore 64, a huge head would appear with a knife, or with a machete stuck in it. You would actually see the carnage. This is the first time I'd ever, you know, this is like serious, you know, R-rated stuff here, at least for the time. And there would be a huge digitized scream. So you're running around trying to hide from Jason, the whole bit. You kind of get caught up in the game, right? And then all of a sudden this frickin' the whole screen goes black and this huge head with a bloody machete stuck in it briefly appears on the screen with a huge blood-curdling scream. Scared the bejesus out of me. The next game I remember giving me some sort of impact on my psyche was an Elvira game, oddly enough, on the Amiga. It was like a 6 or 7 disc game, and it was a hybrid sort of a hybrid adventure game. One of those ones where there were graphics on the top but kind of text on the bottom. There wasn't a lot of typing involved. I mean, you could use the joystick, but it was sort of intended to be sort of a split-level type adventure game. And this game actually had some genuine moments of just what the hell. You know, from a graphic perspective, from a story perspective, it was a very creepy, creepy game. Now, of course, the next stage of evolution, of course, would be full motion video. And most of you know I'm a huge fan of Night Trap. And, of course, most people hate Night Trap. But as gaming goes, for me, the more realistic you could make it, the better, right? In terms of eliciting that sort of fear. Well, Night Trap on the Sega CD was indeed a full motion video horror game. Now, okay, it wasn't that scary, all right? It was kind of tongue in cheek. It was kind of a parody of a horror show. But there were a couple of scenes that were genuinely creepy. When one of the girls got taken down, what they would do is they had these creepy guys dressed in black, right? And what's funny is they weren't vampires. The family running the house were vampires, but not these creepy guys that you were constantly killing throughout the game by springing traps. But in one case, a couple of them grabbed this girl who puts on a decent performance. It's not Dana Plato, it's one of the other ones. Puts on a pretty good performance, and they have this hook, sort of like one of those hooks that, you know, in the old vaudeville thing where they put it around your waist and pull you off the stage. This hook went around the girl's neck, and they like closed a clamp on the girl's neck, and they were pulling the blood out of her with this device. And, you know, while the rest of it was kind of tongue-in-cheek and funny, this actually felt like a violation of some sort. This actually felt like almost like a rape, is how I remember it feeling. Now, obviously, it's probably not as fun now, but back at the time, that was huge. Now, we could talk about modern games like Silent Hill and things like that, Resident Evil, of course, but, you know, this is retro gaming radio, so I'm trying to keep this limited to the games, you know, 8-bit, 16-bit style stuff that was spooky. So what game scared the bejesus out of you? I'd love to know. Send it in. Post on the forums. We'd love to know what games, maybe I missed something that was really spooky to you. I'll tell you a game that was spooky too, was Jet Set Willy. Any of those weird ZX Spectrum games that came over from the UK that got ported for the C64, toilets chasing after you, giant knives and scissors, not so much scary, but what the hell? Anyway, tell us what you think. Tell us what your scary games are. We'd love to know. Well, because we have so many great reviews on the slate for next month, we're going to give you a pinball update this month. So we have two major pinball packages out there for portables and consoles, and that is the Pinball Arcade and Zen Pinball. Now, these are available on all sorts of different formats, whether you've got a PC or Xbox, PS3, Android tablets, iOS tablets, you name it. This stuff's out there for it. So chances are likely you can get any or all of these new tables by the time you hear this show. So first up, let's update with the Pinball Arcade. Now, the Pinball Arcade is what I would call more along the lines of a pinball reconstruction, right? That's their job. They go out and they license real tables, and they reproduce them perfectly, or as perfect as possible, based on, you know, what they've got for hardware to work with. I mean, they break the units apart. They scan each and every item in high definition. It's fantastic what they do. So, as of between last month and this month, we've had four tables with two more on the way. The four tables that are out now, the new ones, are Elvira and the Party Monsters, which if you had an Atari Lynx, oddly enough, you had a recreation of that at one time. It's amazing how good it was considering what the Atari Lynx was. That's a very nice, more modern table, lots of missions, things like that. Taxi also is a slightly more simplex table, but Taxi's a lot of fun. It is one of those more simple mission type games, but it's so well done. It's got those early sound samples. It's just got a piece of nostalgia to it. Also available, the second Elvira pinball game, Scared Stiff, just recently became available. And much like Elvira and the Party Monsters, it also has a lot of missions, a lot of speech, a lot of atmosphere that follows the whole Elvira mantra. So you'll like that if you're a big fan of Elvira pinball. And they're good, solid pinball tables. All three of those are really good pinball tables. I would recommend any of them for purchase. Big Shot is the fourth table. Now, Big Shot is an electromechanical pinball machine, meaning it is antiquated, shall we say. It is very simplex in terms of, you know, there's not really missions and there's not dot matrix displays and all that other stuff. But there's a definite charm to the old electromechanical pinballs. I think Big Shot is the freebie this month. So for the entire month, you'll be able to play Big Shot for free on the Pinball Arcade. So you might want to give that one a shot and see if it rubs you right. Some people absolutely adore old electromechanical tables. For me, it has to be the right IP and it has to be the right table. So I'm kind of on the fence with Big Shot. I like it, but it's not, you know, $6 Million Man. It's not 8 Ball Deluxe. It's not those older electromechanical tables that really have a huge history behind them that a lot of people have heard or seen. So that's good, though. The next two that are coming are Twilight Zone, which, I mean, that's like one of the biggest tables of all time. Twilight Zone and Addams Family. Between the two of them, they're huge. Now, we're only getting Twilight Zone, but I'll take it, right? Twilight Zone's awesome. The next one, which was funded by Kickstarter, was Star Trek The Next Generation. Now, that is a fantastic pin. If you've not had the opportunity to play Star Trek The Next Generation, you are in for a huge treat. Very mission-based, very IP-heavy, tons of fun, lots of great music, lots of great sound effects. Believe me, it was worth kicking in for Kickstarter for. So that wraps up the Pinball Arcade. Next up, Zen Pinball has, get this, five tables since we last talked. Five tables. Most of it's Marvel-related stuff. That seems to be Zen Pinball's latest trend, is to do one unique table that they've created and then a whole bunch of Marvel tables, right? That seems to be where they're making their money, and they're going to keep doing it. So let's start off with World War Hulk. That is a very ramp-heavy table. It's not a bad table. It's just another Marvel-themed table. If you look at it and you go, well, you know, there's nothing that just jumps right out at you. It's another Marvel-themed table. I'm not sure there's any other better way I can put that. If you've played some of the other Marvel tables, this is about average. You know, if you really love the Marvel tables, you're going to want to add this to your collection. Otherwise, you know, you might hold off. The next table up is Tesla, based on Nikola Tesla's life in fantastic. It's all that, I think it's called steampunk. You know, it's got that sort of a chaos engine look to it. Everything's like steam mechanical type things. It's really, really well done. And it's a lot more what I would consider a could be in real life table. There's got to be a good name for that. A reality table where you could literally see the Tesla table appearing in an arcade somewhere, where you look at World War Hulk and some of their other tables, and it's like, yeah, we'll never see that table out in the wild. But you could see Tesla. So I recommend that one hands down. I mean, you don't even need to think about it. That one's a purchaser. The last couple of days, we've seen three more tables come out, two Marvels and one standalone, or non-Marvel IP, I should say. The first one up is Ghost Rider. And I like the Ghost Rider franchise. I liked the Nicolas Cage movie, the first one anyway. And so I was kind of excited to play that, and I got a few minutes into it, and it's just like, you know, it's not rubbing me right, so let's check out the next one. So I moved on to Blade. Now, Blade is one killer table. It's got tons of cool effects. It's got nice missions. It's a well-laid-out table. It doesn't sucker punch you on the side ramps and the drink hole. So it's entertaining, it's fun, it's got some really cool effects. I'll share one with you, even though it was kind of more cool to have as a surprise. But you play the pinball at night and during the day, right? So during the day you have certain missions you can do, and at night you have certain missions to do. And when the time gets down to it and it's nighttime, the entire table goes dark. It's a really cool effect. The table goes all dark and you can really see the spot lamps as they're showing you what to do and where to go. And like I said, there's a whole different set of missions. And at some point, vampires get into your complex and all of the balls turn into these glowing orbs. It is totally cool. So I really, really, really like the Blade table. And I know that one's available at least on Pinball Effects on the 360, thanks to one of the listeners. They shared that with me on Google+. So I definitely recommend that table. The next table and the last table for Zen Pinball is Paranormal. And Paranormal is sort of a, almost like a Sherlock Holmes meets, you know, ghosts and goblins type thing. It's a very decent table. It's got a lot of, it's a little heavy for, what I would consider a real life table. So it's one of those ones where it kind of steps back and forth between the realistic versus fantasy pinball. Sometimes I like fantasy pinball. I really do. But most of the time I prefer to stay firmly grounded in realistic physics, realistic toys, and that sort of thing. And Paranormal really stays in that area. And it's only 99 cents this month too, probably until they release the next set of tables. So for a buck, it's definitely well worth your money. The other ones you might want to go and watch some video and see how the table layouts work, because you may or may not like these Marvel tables. I can recommend Blade without even thinking twice about it. So you'll definitely want to check that out. And mind you, there's a whole ton of other very nice pinball sets out there, depending on your device and your console. So you might want to go check that out if you're not thinking in terms of, well, you know, this is it. It's arcade pin or pinball arcade and Zen Pinball. That's all Shane ever talks about. And it's true because, you know, there's a constant feed of new tables coming into that. But that doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of other probably cheap and or free pinball tables that you can get out there. One of them's really interesting. It's called, I didn't write this down on my notes. I think it's called, something like World War Pinball, something like that. Anyway, it's based on a whole bunch of Universal Studios titles, like Navy SEALs. What were some of those other? There was like three or four themes on there. It was Navy SEALs, Platoon, and maybe, what was the other one? Hang on a second, I'm going to look it up. It's worth it. Yeah, it's called War Pinball HD. And it's got Platoon, Navy SEALs, and Missing in Action. Yeah, it's actually remarkably decent. It's $3, so it's a buck a table. And they're all really heavily themed, and, you know, they're loaded with lots of samples from the movies, and there's tons of ramps. They're very, very traditional tables. And at first you're playing them going, you know, I don't know if I like this. But then all of a sudden it's going, you know, this is kind of fun. And apparently this one is available also if you have an Amazon Kindle Fire. Apparently there's not a lot of pinball available for the Amazon Kindle Fire, but this one is available. So if you're looking for a great pinball experience, but you can't get in on the ones that we keep talking about, there you go. And finally, there's another one called Pinball HD for Tegra. If you've got a Tegra-based Android device, and I think this is available for iOS, but I'm not positive. It may be a Tegra-only type deal, but it's called Pinball HD. It also comes with a handful of tables, Wild West, The Deep, and Jungle Style. And again, it's the same idea. Each table's got its own theme, and they're more realistic tables. There's not weird hands jumping out of the side of the walls and all that sort of thing. So it's definitely a more legitimate type of a pinball style. And you can actually do it in 3D if you'd like. You can put on some stereo glasses, you know, and play the game in 3D. It doesn't look that good. I tried it. Just, you know, that's what you're paying me to do. And it doesn't look all that good. But it's still a very, very nice, it's a very, very nice title if you're looking for more pinball. And it's Tegra only, you know, so it looks very clean. Well, that wraps it up. I'm sorry we only talked about pinball this review cycle, but again, I've got so much coming for next month that I just didn't have time to get anything nailed down for this month. But I hope you enjoyed it anyway, and we'll be back next month, of course, with reviews of the 8-Bitty, the MCC216, and hopefully other good stuff. So we'll see you next month on that. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for the October 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. A couple of quick things I'd like to remind you of. First off, we do have a Twitter feed, so do follow us at Retro Gaming Radio, minus the O at the end, Retro Gaming Radio. Yeah. I'm sorry, they wouldn't let me have an O at the end. Too many characters or something. So, Retro Gaming Radio on Twitter. You can also circle us up at Google Plus. There is a dedicated Retro Gaming Radio page. Now, there's a little bit of confusion which Retro Gaming Radio is the right one. I do have a Retro Gaming Radio account that I originally set up to use on Google Plus, but it's hard. It's a pain to change between accounts and administrate. Once they added pages to Google Plus, I created a new page that's under my regular Shane R. Monroe account. So, if you see the one that looks like the cover of a Retro Gaming Radio DVD, you can circle that one if you want, but I don't check it very often. Circle the one that's got my eyeball covered with the Pac-Man, like on the website. That's the one you want to circle. Eventually, I'm going to kill that other one or rebrand it or something so people aren't confused. But suffice to say, that's the one you want to circle up. You can, of course, circle me up at Shane R. Monroe at Google. Our producer, Alex J. Lopez, is also on Google+. Feel free to circle him up as well. We talk about half this stuff all the time anyway. And don't forget our sister show, Passenger Seat Radio, my 13-mile commute to work. It's more of a social commentary show. We do get a little bit racy, and there's a little bit of profanity. So if you're looking for a little more adult retro gaming radio that's a little more issue-driven and a little more social commentary style, then you might want to check that out, passengerseatradio.monroeworld.com. And let's see, what else am I missing? Oh, the 24-hour shoutcast. Alex J. Lopez maintains a shoutcast of retro gaming radio, classic retro gaming radio. Just go to shoutcast.com, search for Retro Gaming Radio. You can listen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you can use your portable mobile device. So if you can download yourself a Shoutcast-compatible application for your cell phone or your tablet, you can listen to the show 24/7, even in your car while you're going to work. So anyway, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. Next month's going to be huge. We're going to have so much to talk about. I've already got reviews lined up. We got the interview with Edgar that's hopefully going to go through. Hey, by all means, we're very excited to have our new listeners. There's tons of new listeners, by the way. For those of you who think that it's just the old fuddy-duddies that are listening to Retro Gaming Radio, the ones that have been here since 1998, not true. We have tons of new listeners, just found the show in the last month or two. Our numbers are steadily increasing, so people are loving the show. Tell a friend, tell a neighbor, shove it down their throat. Tell them they must listen to Retro Gaming Radio. No, I'm just kidding. Tell them about the show. I mean, there's a huge horde of 30 and 40-somethings people that need this show. Some of them have told me that. They absolutely need the show. Some of them are crippled without having this show every month. So take that for what it's worth. All right, folks, this is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying until next time, keep it retro.